I declare the meeting open at 5:30 p.m. I welcome councillors, management and members of the public in attendance to the City of Melbourne. We respectfully acknowledge the traditional owners of the land, the Boon Wurrung and the Woiwurrung Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation, and pay respect to their elders past and present. For the Kulin Nation, Melbourne has always been an important meeting place of events of social, educational, sporting and cultural significance. Today we are proud to say that Melbourne is a significant gathering place for all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. I take this opportunity to notify members of the public that it's being streamed live on the City of Melbourne's website, and audio and video recording will also be published on the Council's website by close of business tomorrow. Whilst we try to avoid filming members of the public who attend or present at this meeting, there is the possibility that your image may be inadvertently captured in the live stream and video recording. The unconfirmed minutes of this meeting will also be available from the City of Melbourne's website as soon as practicable. And should you have any questions or queries relating to the conduct of the meeting, the documentation or the submission process, please speak with a member of the Council business team after the meeting. I request that all mobile phones be turned off or to silent for the duration of the meeting. And the agenda tonight comprises four reports from management and one item of general business. We've got apologies from the Lord Mayor Sally Capp and Councillors Lee Liu and Oak. And I advise members of the committee and the public that where the committee makes a decision on the basis of fewer than six members voting in favour of it, the decision may be referred by a councillor to council for decision. If any councillor has either an indirect or direct interest as defined in the Local Government Act 1989 in relation to a matter to be considered by a committee, please disclose the type and nature of your interest prior to consideration of the item. I call on a councillor to move a resolution adopting minutes of open meeting number 65 held on Tuesday the 1st of October. Councillor Pinder and a seconder. Councillor Riley, I put that to the vote. All those in favour? I declare that carried unanimously. I ask councillors, are there any matters arising from the minutes of the previous meeting? No, thank you. The following submissions have been received in accordance with the Council's Meeting Procedures Code in relation to Agenda Item 6.1, the Transport Strategy 2030. We've got requests to speak from Michael Smith, Anthony Hargraves, Tony Penner, Jackie Frostacki, Stuart Norman and Chris Thrum. We've got items of correspondence from Tyce van der Heyden, Shay Sutherland, Craig Richards, Stephen Main, Maureen Harris, Cameron Munro, Jackie Frostacki, Tony Penner, Stuart Norman and Chris Thrum. And in relation to Agenda Item 6.2, Planning Permit Application TP 2019-342, 10 to 16 MacKillop Street, Melbourne. We've got a request to speak from Amanda Broadbent and Nick Tazoo. Items of correspondence from Chun Tang, Deanne Butterworth, Michael Munson, Jennifer Boyle and Amanda Broadbent. And in relation to Agenda Item 6.3, Ministerial Planning Referral, TPM 2018-23, 28 to 38 Pearl River Road and 3 to 43 Waterfront Way Docklands, Ali Harrington, request to speak, and an item of correspondence from Ali Harrington as well. In relation to Agenda Item 6.4, the Ministerial Planning Referral, TPMR 2019-1, 423 Burke Street, 140 Queen Street, 150 Queen Street and 21 to 27 MacKillop Street, Melbourne. We've got requests to speak from Sian Davies, Sarah Horsfield, Catherine Barber, Sonia Ordino and Ciro Figaro. Items of correspondence from Catherine Barber, Sonia Ordino, Rowan Story and Ciro Figaro. In relation to Agenda Item 7.1, Notice of Motion, Councillor Nick Francis-Gilley, ensuring safety of children at place of worship in our municipality. We've got items of correspondence from Chris Pearce, from Jacinta Bright, Bryony Russell and Heather Wellington. After that extensive list, I ask if there's anyone here tonight that is wishing to submit that we haven't covered off on. No? Got that. Thank you, Stephen. Chris? Anyone else? No? Thank you. I advise submitters that you're invited to address the committee at the relevant at the time the relevant agenda item is considered. You've got 3 minutes to address the committee. It's the intention with quite a number of speakers tonight, as it is any night, to adhere to the 3 minute time limit. To assist you, we've got a counter on the wall. Beeps will sound at the completion of 2 minutes, signalling you've got 1 minute remaining to conclude your address. You'll get another beep to sound out the time that is allocated to you has concluded. In accordance with the Council Meeting Procedures Code, a 15-minute period will be provided at the beginning and at the end of this meeting for members of the public to ask questions. They shouldn't be longer than 90 seconds. It's not a time for submissions, it is a time for questions. Submitters will be invited to address the committee at the time the relevant agenda item is considered. I now invite questions from members of the public. If you'll just put your hand up there. Yes, sir. Your name?
My name's Alfredo
Malatola. Alfredo. Tony Penner. No, I'm just going to get the list of people wanting to add. Just up the back here. And David beside you. And Stephen Moan. Anyone else? Alfredo, if you'd just like to make your way to the lectern here. We apologise, we've got a new lectern which is sadly put the monitor directly in the area where we struggle then to see your face a little bit, so we apologise in advance, but okay. Alfredo, please, your question.
All right, hi. My name's Alfredo Malabella. I'm 60 years old. I'm a single father of two boys, Fabian, 30 years old, who's the carer of my second-born, Julian, who's an autistic adult. I have been a single father for 19 years. I moved to Melbourne after a marriage breakup in Sydney 3 years ago. I'm a professional musician, a pianist. This is what I've done, and mixed touring and performing, as well as being a father, as well as being the manager of an autism program. On the 11th of December, I signed a lease at 140 to 146 Lygon Street, Carlton. Previous restaurant used to be called La Notte. Now I've called it the Rattlesnake Saloon. Basically aiming at, I've travelled the world 35 times. I've performed lots and lots of places. I've got ideas. I came to Lygon Street. It broke my heart. I came and I was ready to open up in the first week of March this year. The Melbourne City Council stopped me. They would not let me open and sell alcohol for 7 months. Every cent that my sons and I, we did it all ourselves.
So, Alfredo, can I just confirm you didn't receive a liquor licence? Is that what occurred?
Sorry, I can't
hear. You didn't receive a liquor licence?
No. We had a liquor licence. The planning, council would not let us go ahead with the planning because they said that it had gone over 2 years without the business had stopped. It took 7 months and $20,000, all the money I had, with my sons and I. We painted, we scraped, we went to garage sales. We basically did the whole thing for like $12,000.
Sure. Alfredo, just what the question is?
The question is, we opened 6 weeks ago. We opened 6 weeks ago with six bottles of booze, a loaf of bread and a carton of Corona. And now we're sort of just making ends meet. We're not out of the clear. Now, I'm a pianist, right?
Alfredo.
The council won't let me play my piano at the restaurant. And it's going to take 90 days for them to say yes or no. Basically, what I'm trying to say is that the Melbourne City Council almost killed me, almost sent me broke, almost bankrupted me. Throughout the last 7 months, I have housed 8 homeless people.
Alfredo, I can.
Yeah, I'm very, very emotional and very, very upset about this.
I absolutely can hear that in your
voice.
They
won't let me play my piano.
I hear that in your voice. It's not
They'll
a time.
They'll fine me $1,000 a day
Alfredo,
if I play a piano.
Alfredo, I hear the passion in your voice. I absolutely understand it. You've got some really specific details. Can we catch up with you after this meeting, and we'll put you in contact with our planning team and see if we can get to the bottom of the issues. Alfredo,
I've done everything with the planning team.
I'm offering to follow up on your query after the meeting, okay. if that's okay.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Alfredo. Tony Penner.
Tony Penner, South Bank Residents Association. Just a point of clarification. Is it correct that the City of Melbourne is now accepting recycling, and is it correct that that recycling is being recycled?
That is correct.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tony. David Leake. Just turn the microphone on there, David. Apologies.
Okay. My name's David Legg. I'm a resident of Melbourne for 20 years, the city. I'm here as and intending to object to the Queen Victoria Market Renewal Program, and I have some questions. The councillors are voting on closing of Franklin Street and closing the existing car park of the market, and there appears to be no business case justification for doing that. I've reviewed today a new version of the business case, the SGS business case, which came at 1 o'clock today, which still doesn't actually deal with the issues when we've got 9.5 to 10 million visitors to the market every year. Half of those visitors come by car. There's no assessment of the value of those visitors and the impact of changing the car park from a current adjacent car park to underground and making access to the car park extremely difficult. So my question is, why is there no assessment of other options to the current Queen Victoria Renewal Program where we could retain some of the existing car park and not have to close off Franklin Street, which will restrict access to the existing car parks, to the new car parks, which are underground and could obviously disproportionately reduce the outcome of the market, which the plan is to keep the market as a working produce
Thanks,
market.
Thanks, David. Absolutely. Thank you for your passion for QVM. I think that it's been a very long process with a number of iterations for the master plan for the market, and obviously economic impact is a big consideration of those. We've got further work on some of the market infrastructure due to keep progressing. So we had an endorsement of a way forward which essentially allows, a staged implementation. Any removal of car parking off the current car parking site has to be met in car parking in other areas. So the Munro site, once that's completed, will have, approximately 500 car parks in it. And then anything that happens with the southern side in terms of what parking occurs there, there's still decisions to be worked through, but we hear you loud and clear on that. I just want to pick up on the closing of Franklin Street. That's not part of the plan at all. There is no plan to close Franklin Street. There are plans to create better pedestrian safety up and down Franklin Street.
My understanding, it's closing all of the west-east section of and all of the public car parking, which is 155 spaces, and selling it as the southern development site.
So Franklin Street, I can absolutely assure you that there is no move to close Franklin Street, which was your question.
That's in terms of Franklin Street as we know it, isn't
David,
it?
David, I'm just
public land, isn't it? Public,
David, yeah. David, I'm answering your questions. It's not a debate, okay? So with
I don't think you are answering your question, to be perfectly honest.
David, just a bit of respect if I could.
Okay.
Thank you. In terms of the parking on the southern site, there are still a number of options to be worked through, but what we have committed to is that there will be no less as part of the agreement than the number of car parks that currently are provided for Queen Victoria Market. Any further detail that you'd like to pick up on in terms of the master plan, we're happy to take that on notice.
Okay.
Thank you.
How can I get questions answered? There seems to be a huge amount of unknown issues here that council is...
If you've got any detailed specific questions, you're more than happy to submit them to us and we can come back to you with absolutely all the detail that you require.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, David. Cheryl McKenna, I think it was.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. That's you up in the corner. I can't see you because I'm in the far corner. Okay, now I know where to look. Thank you. My name's Cheryl McKenna and I'm, like David, a resident of Melbourne and live up near the Queen Victoria Market, actually right on the corner of Coyne Street and Franklin Street. I've got a number of concerns about the proposed developments of the Queen Victoria Market and the way they impact on the surrounding area, the way the surrounding area will impact on the Queen Victoria Market. One of the things that concerns me, and I've spent the last few days wading through numerous papers from your organisation is why there's no traffic assessment of the proposed road closures, which are being added, or discontinuance of part of Franklin Street and discontinuance of part of Queen Street. Why there's no traffic assessment of those proposed road discontinuances, together with an impact of all the development that's either been approved or is under construction in the local area. There are going to be an additional over 5,000 new apartments, and that must bring more traffic into the area because most of those new developments have car parking spaces.
So, Cheryl, you're asking about a traffic assessment?
Yes. I can't find a traffic assessment that's been done. The last one I saw was dated 2016, when the plan was to straighten Franklin Street so it connected with the Dudley Street roundabout, in shorthand terms. And it makes no mention, that traffic assessment makes no mention of the closure by Metro Tunnel of the top half of Franklin Street.
So thank you for your question. And what we'll do is, because there's a bit of detail around that is required, we'll come back to you on that. But rest assured, we'll come back to you on your question around traffic assessment impacts.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Stephen Mayne.
Thank you, Acting Lord Mayor. I've got two questions. First one is, did councillors see this cartoon today in the Herald Sun, which I thought was demeaning in its depiction of our Lord Mayor, and continues on the sort of hysterical
Stephen,
coverage.
Is the question, did we see the cartoon?
Yes, so the question is, did you see the cartoon today, and do you have any reflections on it? You might have reflected on it during the transport debate. I noticed that the Herald Sun hasn't done any submissions on that, so they're only communicating.
Stephen, thanks
paper,
for your question. Yes, I believe most councillors have seen it, and we'll wait to the debate on the transport strategy item for that.
Okay, great. My second question is, I've distributed to councillors an extract from the 2015-16 annual report showing very comprehensive related party transaction disclosures of councillors, and then also an extract from the 2017-18 annual report where this information has all been slimmed down to one paragraph saying there were $338,000 worth of related party transactions. I'm wondering if the councillors are prepared. I understand this change is in accordance with how the accounting standards have changed and the guidance you've received from Local Government of Victoria. So the question I'm going to ask you, and I know it's too late for this year's annual report, is that for next year's annual report, would councillors be prepared to move back on a voluntary basis to the best practice, very comprehensive related party transactions as demonstrated on page 208 of the 2015-16 annual report, which I've circulated to councillors tonight?
Thanks, Stephen. We'll take that on notice and happy to come back to you, but thanks very much for your question.
Okay, thank you.
I now call on Councillor Francis Gillie to assume the role of Chair in relation to the transport portfolio.
Thank you, Acting Lord Mayor. there is one report from management for consideration under the transport portfolio, agenda item 6.1, Transport Strategy 2030. Would councillors like a presentation on this agenda item? No, I don't think they do. I now call upon Michael Smith, who requested the opportunity to address the committee in relation to this matter, to speak for no more than 3 minutes. And Michael, there's a counter up there to help you watch the time. It will beep when you've got 1 minute left.
Thank you, councillors, for the opportunity to speak to you this evening. My name's Michael Smith. I'm an architect, urbanist, and proud citizen of Melbourne. I wanted to speak to you today about some of the impacts of the transport plan before you. Firstly, I'd like to discuss the economic impact. By increasing the pedestrian footpaths, reducing car lanes, and creating protected cycling paths, you're highly likely to increase the number of customers for shops and restaurants in the city. Retail spaces rely heavily upon pedestrian footfall for their business, and this plan is likely to increase that footfall. This transport plan could create a more prosperous city. Secondly, the social and health impacts are likely to be considerable. By providing protected bike lanes, hundreds of serious injuries each year might never happen. More people would be encouraged to use active transport modes and will likely have additional health impacts such as reduced cardiovascular problems and reduced cases of mental health issues. In allowing more street space to be vegetated, the impacts of the urban heat island effect might also be reduced. This, again, will reduce the demand for medical services, particularly in the summer months. From an environmental perspective, this plan will also have some significant impacts. A reduction in the number of cars travelling into the CBD will result in better air quality and, to a degree, less noise. The increased vegetation is likely to attract bird life and insects and more and that are important to ecosystems. Ultimately, this plan makes it look like council is acting in response to a climate or biodiversity crisis. I think what this plan is really asking is the City of Melbourne prepared to live with the benefits of such a scheme? Are we prepared to put up with the increased prosperity, resilience, and improved health and environmental outcomes that this plan facilitates? Finally, I'd like to draw attention to the unusual conception of this scheme. State and federal governments typically would create such a policy using methods such as the back of the envelope or a press conference thought bubble. Occasionally, they outsource this step completely to the private sector. This transport plan, however, has been prepared with both evidence and community consultation by experts. These experts are highly regarded in their field and are promoting techniques that have been proven to work elsewhere. Can we really trust a plan that was derived from such an unusual process? Yes, absolutely we can. It's not radical. In fact, it's the only way our city can grow and remain livable. Please support the transport plan. Thanks.
Michael, thank you. And have you ever thought of writing for the Herald Sun? I now call on Anthea Hargreaves to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome, Anthea.
Evening, Chair, councillors and committee. I'm here speaking on behalf of Bicycle Network. My CEO, Craig Richards, is an apology today. The City of Melbourne's 2030 transport strategy is a promising step forward. It recognises that with population growth, our city can no longer be built to cater for the movement of cars over the movement of people. Each day, tens of thousands of people choose to come to the City of Melbourne by bike. While for them it is convenient, for society, bicycle transport is cost, space and energy efficient. Significantly more people will ride a bike in the City of Melbourne when more places to ride separate from vehicles are provided. Further, those who occasionally ride bikes will ride more often. Accordingly, the strategy of increasing the number of separated bike lanes is an important one the Council should support. Over the past 10 years, Melbourne has made steady progress with improved separated facilities on streets such as Latrobe Street and Elizabeth Street and new facilities on the way on William and Exhibition Streets. However, there is still much to be done. Imagine riding a bike from the corner of Spring and Flinders Street to the corner of Lonsdale and Spencer Street. It's currently a journey only for the less than 1% of people classified as the strong and fearless. This should be a trip the majority of people in Melbourne would be comfortable pedalling. The City of Melbourne has a vital leadership role to play. With the state government seemingly ambivalent about encouraging bike riding, we need the City of Melbourne to lead the way. This will embolden the adjoining councils to provide separated places to ride that connect with those provided by the City of Melbourne. Simply, if Melbourne is to continue to be one of the world's great cities, bikes must be a part of our future. The 2030 strategy is an important step in that direction that the council should support. Thank you.
Thank you, Anthea. I now call on Stuart Norman to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Thank you, Stuart.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, councillors of the City of Melbourne. I'm the CEO of Parking Australia, which is the industry body for the parking industry, of which the City of Melbourne was a founding member in 2006, and we thank you for their contribution. Congestion in Melbourne is a significant issue, and as identified in the plan, 43% of congestion in Melbourne is caused by through traffic. This is our major concern, and our concern is that by discouraging people to drive to the city, we're actually doing that at the detriment of those people who are driving into the city to park and therefore contribute to the economic welfare of the city. So our view is, yes, get rid of congestion by trying to divert cars out of the city that are passing through, but not at the detriment of those who want to come and park. So we fully support the intent of the plan around congestion. We also fully support the council's demand-driven on-street parking. This is a market-based demand system which we fully support. However, there are some areas of this which I believe the plan has skimmed over. It talks about the use of sensor technology. Yes, sensor technology does have its place. But if you go to Auckland, where Auckland Transit run all of the transport, there is not one sensor in Auckland at all, and they use world's best practice camera technology. This is not mentioned in the plan. Also in the plan, it talks about technology, but the technology is not customer-focused. It's about technology for management, not technology for the end user. If you look at the new parking technology in Adelaide, it allows consumers to be able to pay a premium for 15 minutes of extra on-street parking, so therefore they can avoid an infringement, but they do pay that extra privilege for the 15. It's customer-focused. That's also missing in the plan. When it comes to off-street parking, we are circumspect about a review of off-street parking and what that might mean. As we've talked about, we do not want congestion to be actually detrimental to those people who want to drive in and park. Parking Australia is all for choice. We believe in choice. We believe in public transport, pedestrians, cyclists. But we do not want the choice of someone who wants to choose to come into the city and drive to be taken away. So in all of that, yes, there is one other aspect we would like to address, and that is the congestion levy. The congestion levy in its current form does not work, and yes, road pricing does have merit, and we would not want double taxation. So if there was to be road usage, no congestion levy on parking spaces. Thank you.
Thank you, Stuart. I now call on Jackie Frassacchi to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Thank you, Jackie. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair, and all councillors. Good evening. My submission is on behalf of myself as an individual, though you will have noticed in my written submission I give my background not only as a councillor of the City of Yarra, but president of the organisation Transport for Everyone, executive member of Rail Futures, treasurer of Metropolitan Transport Forum of 25 councils, and member of the Victorian Transport Action Group. This strategy is a critical strategy, not just for the Melbourne City Council area, but surrounding inner city municipalities, such as my own, but for all of Melbourne. This is a far-sighted transport strategy, and I urge it to be adopted, hopefully unanimously, as the draft was adopted for consultation. Adoption is strongly urged with its laudable goals to meet Melbourne's transport needs by improving conditions and infrastructure for pedestrians, cyclists and public transport users through safe and sustainable forms of transport. And I'm happy to endorse the comments made earlier by the first two speakers, Emma Hargraves and Michael Smith, on those areas. Melbourne plays a major role in Melbourne's Melbourne City Council plays a major role in Melbourne's livability and mobility. It's acknowledged that walking, cycling and public transport are the most effective, efficient and emission-friendly means of transport. Melbourne's target of, or the proposed target of 70% for all trips by sustainable modes, walking, cycling, public transport, is achievable. It means reducing motor vehicle traffic from the current 43% to 30%, but with the projections of Melbourne's population increasing and throughput into the city increasing, it's imperative that we don't increase the 43% with the extra population. I've just returned from a transport study to Vancouver where the target is 67% of all trips by sustainable modes. It is achievable. Vancouver is a much bigger city, so it's harder to get to the 70%, but it's a pretty achievable mode and an imperative with the population increase we're going to have. I strongly support limiting speeds through the municipality to 40 kilometres per hour. We have that in the city of Yarra, and it would be great to be standard on to have it on all local roads. And of course, noting that some streets are 30, like Swanson, and I hope the little streets can become formally 30 as well. You can't go much more than that. Supporting the network of protected bike lanes is critical for safety and to avoid that dreaded car dooring problem, being a victim of that myself. Traffic counts also show that women reach 40% mode share on safe cycle routes, and we need that. I think that might mean my time's up, but you can read my points 5 and 6. In conclusion, please adopt this strategy. It is integral to be adopted, and look forward to working with you on that.
Jackie, thank you very much. For those of you who don't know, I think Jackie has probably been one of the great advocates of transport in this city and beyond for many years. So, Jackie, thank you for coming along tonight, and thank you for speaking to the transport strategy. I now call upon Tony Penner to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Thanks, Tony.
Councillors, Chair, Tony Penner, South Bank Residents Association. We at the South Bank Residents Association were pleased to be able to contribute to this draft or to this strategy, and we submitted our feedback accordingly. I would like to commend the responsible officers at the City of Melbourne for their dedication and hard work that obviously has gone into the development of this strategy. The South Bank Residents Association is supportive of many of the policies discussed in the strategy document, but notes there is little consideration given to South Bank in this strategy. The safety and amenity of the rapidly growing residential population and many tourists accommodating the South Bank must be considered, but there seems to be little specific mention of how the strategy will address the key areas of concern for our suburb with the highest density of residents in Australia. Areas of particular concern which we feel have been overlooked is that the reduced traffic along City Road and Power Street, the placarded roads and the livestock trucks. This is an issue that we have been bringing up with this council, well, for the last 7 years that I've been president, and unfortunately, I certainly didn't see any mention of that particular road in the strategy. It is a key concern for South Bank residents, and this council is very aware of that. We're surprised that it was missed. Other concerns would be the narrowing of footpaths. We talk about the importance of footpaths and the space that's required for pedestrian traffic. We have seen a very recent example in South Bank where the footpath on Cavanagh Street has been narrowed by half a metre, citing, according to council officers, the reason being for the urban forest strategy to have more green space. So we need to get that balance right as to what's important. Is the green space more important at the expense of the congestion of residents, or is it not? I'm still addressing that issue with council officers with the narrowing of our footpath. The entire strip of Cavanagh Street is 2.5 metres, except for the latest addition to the footpath, which went down to 2 metres right in the middle. Also, particular concern about the better management enforcement of pick-up and drop-off practices by commercial passenger vehicles, Uber, etc., and also taxis. We know that we've got critical concerns with taxis along Whiteman Street at the casino and also Queensbridge Street in particular. Your council officers are addressing these concerns as we speak, but we didn't see a lot of discussion of this in the transport strategy about how we can get that balance right. Overall, we believe that the Transport Strategy 2030 is very positive, with a clear commitment to improving the safety and amenity of visitors and residents in the City of Melbourne. Considering the population density of South Bank and the volume of active transport users is only increasing, we trust future actions to achieve the strategy will be prioritised in future budgets. Thank you.
Tony, thank you for your, contribution. I now call upon Chris Thrum to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you, Councillor Nicholas Francis Skilly, Acting Lord Mayor Aaron Wood, men and women of the Kulin Nation. I'd like to thank the managers and the officers involved in compiling the Transport Strategy 2030 report. Just a couple of brief points that I'd like to make. I think it's important that we address the transport issues and future problems that we'll be facing in Fisherman's Bend. I think we need to have an underground railway line from Southern Cross Station all the way out to Newport going underneath the Yarra River. We've got to look to what would Melbourne be like in the 22nd century, and with the population that we'll be having at Fisherman's Bend, we do need to envision having a superior transport system there. Also, too, a priority should be to have tram systems involved in travelling or getting the members of the public from Fisherman's Bend into the central business district of Melbourne. I'd also like to thank Jackie Fustacchi for all the work she's done in compiling her contributions to the Melbourne City Council. I know that's very greatly appreciated. And also, too, I think one issue that I think we can address as well in the future would be ferry services and water taxis along the Yarra River into South Bank and into the Central Business District, as well as Docklands. I think there's a lot of scope there for improvement. I think we've got ferries from Williamstown and Frankston as well in the future would be beneficial for the City of Melbourne, St Kilda as well. All up to tremendous report, very ambitious as well in many of its goals. And to conclude, I'd like to thank, again, the managers and the officers involved in compiling this report.
Thank you, Chris. I'd now like to move the amended motion on the screen. I will move that motion, and I call for a councillor to second the motion. Thank you, Councillor Neppert. I would like to speak to the motion, clearly. Hi, well, welcome, and thank you for all of your contributions. I think I might just start by saying there's a whole bunch of you here that have had a lot to do with this staff over a few years now. Congratulations, right? You know, you've done an extraordinary piece of work. I'm not going to name you all because actually there were so many people involved, and it would be, you know, to talk about who's been involved in this in the city, you know, there are so many, and I know that you've worked a lot and a long time. So thank you. It is a bold strategy, and it does lay out a future for this city that I think that recognises that we are a city with streets wide enough to have trees and dappled light, to have tables and chairs and drink coffee, to have trams running down the middle of them, to be able to enjoy being in the city and moving from place to place. And I think one of the things that we've done in this is look at what's happening around the world. I was reading the stats on consultation. We consulted in terms of taking this discussion over the last 2 years. More than 100,000 video views, 16,000 reactions on social media, 45 formal submissions across Victoria. You know, it's an extraordinary desire to hear what is best practice and what the people of this city want. So it's a transport strategy that we get to discuss as councillors tonight, but it's already the city's, in a way. It's already out there and being owned by people, and we've seen that in the submissions tonight. And so to all of you who submitted, you know, thank you for that. I want to say that there are many things that people have brought to this. I think there's some things that we're going to feel immediately, and then there are some things that are in the future. I think immediately we're going to be able to think about unifying the speed across the city and line it up with those councils that are nearest, so that people aren't travelling at 40 and then 50 and then 60 and then back to 40 again. But that actually there's a speed that keeps people safe, that we understand, that everybody knows. I think that's going to be really simple, and it's going to save lives, and it's going to make the city safer. It's actually not going to slow the journeys down through the city, because we're not going as fast as 40 through the city anyway, but it is going to make it a lot safer, and it's going to calm the city. I think it's going to do some things immediately in terms of our planning, in looking at ways of creating more space for the 90% of journeys that happen which are on the pavements. And Tony, you're right, we have really got to get that balance between trees and pavements right. But at the moment, 90% of the journeys, people have voted with their feet. They're on their feet and they're walking. And so we really immediately are going to move to remove some of the things that are on the pavements. And we're not going to do that in a heavy-handed way. We're going to do it in an enabling way. So we've said, right, well, motorbikes take up a lot of that space. What should we do about that? We're going to put lots of motorbike free parking on the road. So we don't. It's not a heavy-handed approach. It's a supportive approach to get, you know, as a motorbike rider who brings his motorbike into the city, you know, it is not great for me to bounce it up onto a curb and then mingle with pedestrians. I would much rather park it on the road. So I think we're going to create places we're going to create the city as soon as we can that becomes safer and gives the space that it can. Over the longer term, we're going to do some things that recognize we need more of that space and we need safer journeys. So the bike path, the segregated bike tracks. We know, for example, that 10% of people from the north of the city come in on bikes. Research says up to 30% would if there were segregated bike paths. Now, that's an extra 20% of journeys that aren't on the tram, that aren't put in a car. That's space that everyone else gets. And those, you know, we've got a healthy citizens that are on their bike, getting their exercise and doing that below trees as they cycle into, you know, that's the kind of city of the future that we want to keep holding on to. And then I think there are some things that are big that we really need to discuss. And in a 10-year plan, they should be there. Things like the congestion charge. Half of the trips through the city are made by people who are just traveling through the city. Now, I think in the amended motion, the Deputy Lord Mayor this morning suggested that we actually really look at that and ensure that we are thinking about the economics of what we're doing and looking at that congestion charge and checking in. I actually think it's really important. And I think debates and cartoons that were in the Herald Sun this morning, and Stephen, yes, I did see it, don't help this debate. We are not suggesting a congestion charge today. We are suggesting that this city needs to think about the fact that if we grow from 900,000 to, you know, 1.4 million people in the next 15 years, and we've already got not much pavement space, we have got to think creatively about that. That's all we're doing. We're recognizing that a beautiful city requires space. And a beautiful people with a third more people who are walking, we need to think about where that space is coming from, and we need an adult and a long-term considered conversation about how we're going to get it. So I think there's some quick things, there's some medium-term things, and there's some longer-term things. To all of you that have, you know, been involved in that, helped shape it, to those of you who have, you know, driven it now for 2 years through the process, thank you all. I really commend to my colleagues, and I am grateful to my colleagues for their support of us getting to this point. With the second, I'd like to speak to the motion. Councillor Leppert.
Thank you, Chair. The day is here at last. I too am very delighted to support this final version of the Transport Strategy 2030. I recall when the 2012 strategy was adopted and the people in the room and the public debate around that moment. And it is wonderful to have seen how the city's approach to transport modelling and how policy has developed has evolved to this point in time. And I just want to sincerely thank Emma and Richard and their entire teams and everyone that they've worked with for compiling what is one of the largest, most complicated but worthwhile research projects to underpin a new transport strategy, which is also de facto policy of the City of Melbourne in so many different areas. It really is a remarkably thorough piece of public policy making, and I'm so delighted that we're supporting it tonight. I hope that we're supporting it tonight. Thank you to the submitters as well. Michael, I love the way you've framed this whole debate perfectly. I think Herald Sun could learn a lot from you as well. Thank you. We've heard a bit about congestion. It's interesting that congestion is always talked about in the context of cars. The largest congestion that we have, the biggest problem we have in the City of Melbourne and the Central City, is congestion on our footpaths. And that is something that we absolutely have to tackle for public safety imperatives. We need to more radically speed up the pace at which we are widening footpaths and recalibrating road space. The population of Melbourne and the state is growing at record rates still, and the roads aren't going to get any wider. They are defined by the built form in the city. So we just have to keep making sure that the closer you get to the middle of the city where there is less room to move, that we are being as clever and efficient as possible in prioritising those modes of transport that will move the maximum number of people and that will keep citizens safe. That is what is underlying this strategy and why we need to continue to reaffirm that policy direction and discussions about congestion and principles that we need to keep allowing anyone who'd like to drive into the city to keep doing so doesn't fit into that context. This strategy is very careful about not declaring war on any particular mode of transport. It talks about essential and non-essential private vehicle movements in and out of the city, and it's taken a very, very balanced view and as accommodating a view as possible while still striving towards a future where we have a much bigger population but we can still all move about the city as efficiently as possible. That does mean more space for pedestrians and it does mean safe spaces for cyclists. We did set some ambitious targets for cyclists which weren't met by this time. This new strategy takes a more aggressive tack in a few directions but reviews why that might not have been. And I think that the public perceptions analysis into cycling in particular is so very, very valuable. Latrobe Street is often put forward as the exemplar of separated bicycle lanes in the city, but we've really analysed the approach to those intersections and what it means to come out of a separated bike lane as you approach an intersection and surveyed people as they do that and come to the conclusion that actually there are even better ways of doing separated cycle lanes inside the city and across the municipality so that we can continue that modal shift and make sure that anyone who would like to ride can. Not everyone's going to ride a bike, and whenever government talks about new strategies for cyclists, often people hear, oh, everyone has to ride a bike now. I get that a lot. I'm a Greens Party member. But this really is a transport strategy for absolutely every mode and considers the balance of our limited resources, our limited public space, as smartly as it possibly can, and I'm so delighted to be supporting it. The consultation was very, very broad. The Herald Sun again has suggested that we've only consulted local residents. That's garbage as usual. Greater Melbourne and all of Victoria has fed into this plan. This is a plan for all of Melbourne. Nearly 1 million people visit the central city on any given day. They're not all local residents to the city of Melbourne. This is a plan for absolutely everyone. It's a strategy for climate mitigation and adaptation. I'm delighted that it's a strategy for social justice. Far too many executives will drive into the city looking to get into their car parks and holding up hundreds of pedestrians on the road while one person in one car will try to get into one place. This isn't an attack directly on them, but we do need to properly assess which vehicles are essential and which vehicles are non-essential, because 100 people is 99 more than one, and this has to be a plan that is equitable for absolutely everyone. So this is a plan for social justice. Finally, it's a plan for economic prosperity. I think the extra additions to the resolution are quite good, because what we find every time that we've done major streetscape upgrades in the city of Melbourne is that footfall will increase and that retail in particular will benefit. I think the more that we measure that and the more that we publish that data, that hard data, as scientifically as we possibly can, the more important that is going to be, because this debate, no, doesn't matter how often we do it, if you don't do it for a few years, the assumption that streetscape upgrades will kill off retail continues to pervade, and I agree that it's counterintuitive sometimes to understand how a streetscape upgrade might benefit retail. So we should constantly measure this scientifically and report that data. So this is a plan for economic prosperity as well. I'm absolutely delighted to support it, and congratulations to everyone involved.
Thank you, Councillor Leppard. Would anybody else like to speak to the motion? Councillor Rees.
Thanks, Councillor Francis Gilley. Can I begin by acknowledging all the hard work you've done on this transport plan? Who's someone who is serving their first term on council and I think their first experience of elected office. I know this has probably been an extraordinary exercise for you, and you know you've worked so hard on it. You've put your heart and soul into it, and well done. I think the document we see today will serve the people of Melbourne very, very well for a long time into the future. So well done to you. Of course, behind every councillor and city strategy, there's a team of people who have also bring great effort and intellect to the exercise. And in this case, I want to single out Richard Smithers, Emma Appleton and Claire Ferris-Miles. I really do think here at the City of Melbourne we are blessed with some very clever people who are really at the forefront of thinking in terms of transport, not just here in Melbourne, but what is best practice around the world. So well done to you. I wanted to briefly address the allegations that have been made that this transport strategy is in some way anti-car. I think the people who are making the allegation that this transport plan is anti-car are actually trying to turn transport policy, are trying to turn urban planning policy into a culture war. In their deranged worldview, this transport plan is somehow the latest manifestation of political correctness run mad. In fact, nothing further could be the truth. The truth is that there is a philosophy behind this policy. It's about putting people first. And when we think about transport and when we think about how we move people around our growing city, we're putting people first. When we look at a street, we don't sort of see a car or a tram or a bike. We see human beings. And what this transport policy does is think deeply about how do we move the people who use our city around in the most effective, efficient way, get them to work, get them to school, get them to the shops, get them home as quickly and safely as possible. And that is what this does. Some people also say that Melbourne is a car city and that will always be a car city. In fact, it is true that 75% of trips around Greater Melbourne are by the motor vehicle. But it's also the case that if you look at cities like Melbourne around the world, there are changes occurring. You know, this debate that we're happening in Melbourne is something that's not unique to Melbourne. You know, only someone in the Melbourne bubble would think that that this is a debate that's only happening in this town. If you look at cities like Los Angeles, Houston, cities across Europe, they are all having a very similar debate to the one that we're having now, and they are all moving in the same direction, and that is towards a multimodal transport system that prioritises modes of transport that allow more people to move more efficiently and safely around their cities. And in most cases, that means moving from motor vehicles into other forms of transport. I also just want to conclude by saying I do think that this transport strategy does include some quite ambitious goals in it, and that's good. That's a good thing. I'm reminded of the Robert Browning poem, which talks about a man's reach should exceed his grasp, or probably in the modern era you would say a man or woman's reach should exceed his or her grasp. And it is true. There are targets in this strategy which we may not reach. Which may not come into our grasp, I should say. But by reaching for them, I think we will take this city into a very positive space, and it's something which we very much need to do. And so I congratulate all involved, and I'll be very pleased to support this policy this evening.
Thank you, Councillor Rees. I call on Councillor Pender.
Thanks, Councillor Rees and Councillor Gilley. I think Councillor Leppard is right. This is a piece of really good public policy. So well done to management. However, the inclusion of 10.5 pleases me greatly because it is critical that we have pulse checks as well, I think, on the economic impact that such a strategy will deliver. And I think there needs to be pulse checks at intervals. And with consultation with the right stakeholders regarding the economic impact, because our retail sector is already on decline, and I think we need to be mindful of that as we move into this wider planning phase. There is a view that we ought to advocate and agitate and do all this with state government, but I am more in favour of collaboration with the state government and having further discussions with them to bring about some sort of alignment with our thinking. Might take a while, but I think that's that's something that I'd be wanting to work through. Any future work on bike lanes needs to be considered. We had, when the St Kilda Road eastern side lanes were first unveiled, we had difficulties with mums with prams and, you know, how they get out of the car, get the pram out, get the baby onto the footpath and they back into the car and lock it up and park and whatever. So that was a bit of difficulty there in 2013 or 14. So I guess I'd like to ensure that we consider the disabled, the elderly and mums with prams and kids, and how are they going to navigate and negotiate parking and looking after their bubs as well. Motorbikes off the footpaths, again, a good idea, because you see the congestion. I mean, I've been tracking this since February last year, and I counted, I think, 24 motorbikes on a footpath one evening, and clearly saw a person in a wheelchair having difficulty to negotiate her way through. So I think that's a very good thing. You know, just today I had a photograph sent to me from a constituent from Franklin Street, and as you walked out of the building that she lives in, it was just bicycles and motorbikes, and there was a lady in a wheelchair waiting to actually get across. So I think we've got to really be mindful of our ageing city as well. It's not only about the young, and increasingly that will happen in the next 5 years with our baby boomers. Overall, I reckon a great plan, save for my comments, and I concur with the comments of the previous councillors.
Thank you, Councillor Pinter. Yeah, Councillor Wood.
Thanks, Councillor Francis Gilley. I'll echo the sentiments and say congratulations on your leadership, and I know it's been a lot of work over a long time to get to this moment. To Emma, to Richard, to the whole team, amazing amount of detail and research backing this up. I think there is so many ticks on this strategy, so many great elements in terms of how it's considered emerging technologies, you know, the impact of future autonomous vehicles, how we equitably share and grow to sort of that 8 to 10 million people in our city, and how we deal with a lot of the pinch points which we're currently seeing at the moment, which are around pedestrian safety and making sure we have that space that people can move about the city safely. And indeed, you know, things like interchanges with public transport. So support a lot of aspects of the strategy. I'm really happy and thankful to Councillor Francis Gilley for the inclusion of 10.4 and 10.5. I just want to touch on those a little bit because with, you know, any big policy pieces or any long-term view strategies like this, it's important we take as many people as we can with us. We're not going to take everyone with us. There are going to be people who are who want the place to stay the same, and as the city grows rapidly, that's just not going to be the case. Obviously, with longer journeys, mass transit is really the way the city has to go. When you see a tram sitting next to a single occupant car, it's pretty easy to see visually just you know, how much you know, that great tram network can get us around the city. So 10.4 is really about the fact that we're in a transition phase. We don't have a state-of-the-art, world-first public transport system. There's a long way to go on integration, on our bus network, bringing that up to really what you'd expect from a good nation like Australia. So in that sort of interim time, we're talking about that through traffic. And I just want to make the point that sort of viewing people who come through the cities as rat runners, I don't think serves us well, because there are people without those options to get to work in a timely manner, get home to their families, and that's just the current situation. That 10.4 is very much about working with the state government to identify, you know, where are those modal shifts that will be required to deliver on the through traffic targets that we've set in the strategy, and then how do we objectively, methodically, data-driven, work towards advocating for many of these outcomes which are not in our remit. You know, if it's a tram extension down Nine Road and that's going to shift X number of people off their private vehicle, then let's go about sort of building the case for that. I think with 10.5, my hope is that, as probably has been mentioned, that what those check-ins show is they give us, as probably Councillor Leppard has outlined, a real robust set of numbers to continually demonstrate the pedestrianisation of the city actually delivers for our business and retail sector as well, and just to ensure that we've got no unintended consequences of some of these shifts we're making in the central city, because we're not the central city and then kind of everyone else. We're a capital city that as has been mentioned, has to be a city for all, a plan for all of Melbourne. And what we need to be acutely aware of is there are many people, you know, in suburban locations and even in some inner city locations and certainly in regional Victoria, that really their only option is the vehicle. So we need to ensure that we're constantly checking in to ensure that we don't get that sort of situation where, you know, the city of Melbourne becomes an island and sort of, you know, people then have to work out how they get in and enjoy the city. We want people coming into the city, but we've got to obviously find room as we grow rapidly. In terms of cycling, I absolutely support the protected bike lane, the investment in that program. But I've got to be honest, I mean, I ride my bike, but I'm a fair weather rider. Absolutely, honestly, I ride my bike when the months are warm. When the rain comes in, I'm not the person who's going to suit up in my full wet weather gear and get to work. So, again, we've just got to be mindful and realistic about some of these modal shifts and just how much they can deliver. That really, that investment in mass transit is going to be absolutely critical. And to do that, obviously, we've got to work hand in glove with the state government. Congestion pricing, I think, when you get sort of 20 or 30% electric vehicles, I think there'll probably be a fairly solid move to congestion pricing, because that fuel excise way of delivering economic return is going to come under some pressure. But I think the strategy hits the right balance in that it's an ongoing conversation. We're not going to bring in congestion pricing. It's not within our power to do so. So this is about actually building the business case and building a congestion pricing system, again, that doesn't have any unintended consequences. And we heard from the submission on parking about, you know, just keeping our eye on the fact that if we've got a congestion price, how does that then marry up with the parking levy as well? But above all, an excellent bit of work, and I look forward to the implementation of the strategy.
Thank you. Councillor Wood. Yes. Yes, please do.
Thank you. Thank you. I agree with what my fellow councillors have said. You know, Melbourne is a dynamic, it's an adaptable city. I do not ride a bike, I do not ride a motorbike, but I do drive into the city in my car. And finding the balance within this strategy, I thought it was moving in a direction which would please most people. I think taking the motorbikes off the street, as they have done in Milan, which I saw firsthand, I thought it was brilliant. And as we've said, we've got to make sure our bicycles riders are as safe as possible. I do thank Councillor Francis-Gilley for the 10.5. It was a major concern to me, with the city being under construction with Metro for the next 4 to 5 years. My mind is, how do these retail businesses stay alive? We do not want empty shops. So I know that there's people on the street that will be walking in, but there's also lots and lots of people that would drive their car. We have many, many car parks around the city. They come in, they park, they walk, they shop, and they take their shopping back to their car. So we have to be mindful that we are looking at so many different groups of people that use our streets, and this is the strategy for the future. I have to say the jury's still out in my mind on the congestion tax, which will not be our decision. It will be a state government decision in the future. So I'm still, you know, waiting to see how that will play out in time to come. But overall, the strategy is excellent. I thank our staff, our officers, for putting it together. And let's just see how it all plays out and hope we can please some of the people all the time.
Thank you, Councillor Riley. Would anyone else like to speak to the motion? Just in summary, thank you all for your contribution. I think it is really worth noting that with a transport strategy for a city, you do that in this country hand in hand with the state. You know, we at the moment, the state have made an extraordinary commitment to public transport. That has been the shift for this city. The reason we have had a 25% drop since 2001 in cars into the city as a proportion of the transport is because of the commitment to public transport. Many of us care extraordinarily about climate change. The public transport that we use is driven by electricity, and once that is renewable, we will really be also therefore shifting quicker to a renewable transport system. I think I'd like to say one thing just as a motorbike rider, and I know I get more emails about this than anything else. There is a state rule that it's a state law that allows motorbikes to drive on the pavement. We are creating the spaces for those people to leave the pavement and stay on the road, just to save my inbox from a lot of people tomorrow morning. So we are making the space. We're making it easier for motorbikes. We're not changing the laws. They're not ours. But in summary, I think we've got to work hand in hand with the state, and we have been doing that, and we're excited to continue doing that. Thank you. Right, I would like to put the motion to the vote. All those in favour of the motion, raise your hands. That's unanimous. I now call on Councillor Rees to assume the role of chair of the meeting in relation to the planning portfolio.
Thank you very much, Councillor Francis Gilley. I might just wait a few seconds for the room to clear. Don't all leave. Please take your seats if you're remaining. All right, there are three reports from management for consideration under the planning portfolio. The first of them is agenda item 6.2, planning permit application TP 2019-342. This is for the property 10 to 16 MacKillop Street, Melbourne. Would councillors like a presentation on this agenda item? I'm taking that as a no, and so I will therefore call on Ashley Trelaw. Oh no, sorry, Ashley actually helped us with the report. I now call on Amanda Broadbent, who requested the opportunity to address the committee in relation to this matter, to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Amanda, are you with us? Welcome to Town Hall, Amanda.
Amanda Broadbent, resident of Melbourne, the Excelsior building. Our Excelsior building is opposite 10 to 16 MacKillop Street, Melbourne. I don't want to come to you and say, I live in the city and I expect complete silence. I live through construction, that's fine. I live through the rubbish truck that comes at 2, the rubbish truck that comes at 3, the rubbish truck that comes at 4, the leaf blower that comes on a Sunday morning at 8 o'clock to look after the one tree that we have on our block. For 20 years, I accept that that's part of my living. But when we look at construction that has surrounded 5 apartment buildings and they would like to put a rooftop bar at eye level with the bedrooms, 8 metres from my bedroom, I would just like to ask the council to say, yes, it is all about the people, but when you all go home at night, we're still there. So if we could just please consider that when building future properties. I mean, we want the bars, we want the restaurants, we want the people, we want the money, we understand that. But if a place has already been established as a dwelling with 5 apartment buildings, we'd just like you to consider the noise of an evening. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Amanda. We may be able to, if you just want to remain, return to your seat, Amanda. Thank you very much for that. Rest assured that your concern will be addressed over the course of this item. I'll now call on Nick Tuzia. Hope I've got that right. Nick, to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome to Town Hall, Nick. I think you know where the lectern is.
Thank you, Councillor Rees and Council. The countdown has started, so thanks very much. I'm a town planner from Planning and Property Partners. I'm representing the permit applicant in this matter. Family business, important project for them. Proud to be behind the lectern on this one and also happy to be engaging with the council on it tonight. I think there may be some concern around the project. We've learnt through the course of the application that the site's previously been used as a nightclub and there have previously been nightclub proposals afoot. I just want to assure the council and the gallery that we're completely independent of that. This is a new proposal, a new applicant. The client's vision for this site and project is a positive. It's not a maximisation play. It's not a major development. It's probably what you describe as a boutique, a low-key development. There's no heritage controls on the site. It's an old building. It's an amalgam of two buildings. It's four and five stories. It's got that sort of Melbourne charming historic laneway character to it. And the client's vision, positively, frankly, is to work with that and keep that masonry. Put in some beautifully architecturally designed steel-framed open windows at the ground level. Enhance the quality of the facade and bring it back to life. It's intended as a respectful and a light touch architectural response that's context driven. The project we think about with this one, it's different. It's a retail. It's the Chanel building that used to be the Scientology building on the corner of Russell and Flinders Lane, but that was retouched a few years ago and really the facade brought back to life in a beautiful way, and that's what this project is about. Yes, there are some upper level additions. They're recessive, they're contemporary, they're elegant. They're of the same height and scale of the building to the north at 20 MacKillop Street. You can't really see them from the street. There's no extra shadow cast. The ESD requirements are met, the waste requirements are met. We're required to have 11 bikes. We're putting in 40. So I think if the lobby was here still in the room, they'd be pleased on that, Bicycle Victoria. And so that's really sort of the key overview of the project. Originally, we were proposing a rooftop cafe, not a bar, just to be really clear on that. There was never a bar proposed on the roof. Our client is talking to some really great quality tenants. The primary driver for the project now is commercial tenants. Commercial tenants want to take office space at level one right through level six to the top of the building, so you won't have that nighttime noise. Commercial use, you won't have the noise on the weekends at night. I think some of the concerns we've heard about rubbish trucks, not something that we can really control throughout collection through the nights and all the rest of it. Smoking outside, not something we can control. We do have a restaurant proposed at the base of the building, but I think you know, for the CBD and the CCZ, and we've had a look at the MSS and it talks about eateries and all the rest of it. So I think from a planning perspective, while we've got sympathy for residents who live in the area, we think it's a reasonable response.
Thanks for your presentation, Nick. If you just want to remain at the lectern for a moment, because we did receive 29 objections to this development. That's the sort of numbers that do very much catch the eye of councillors. So I want to go directly to the point which was raised by Amanda Broadbent, and that is the bar on the, I think it's the upper two levels. Tell us what in the proposal is proposed for the upper two levels of the building.
Purely now commercial office floor space, and that was depicted and shown. We had an RFI some months ago, so that's been part of the proposal for the last 3 months at least. So there's no bar at the roof.
And in terms of other hospitality that's occurring in the building,
yes.
My understanding is that there'll be a restaurant potentially at the ground level and the basement. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's one of those older buildings with MacKillop Street grades down, so you've got a partially exposed, you know, basement, not unlike Coda on Oliver Lane and Flinders Lane, that kind of situation, or Il Salito Posto, where you can kind of see down into the activity, and then you've got a ground floor as well. So it's that basement and ground. We're talking about restaurant use, and then above there, purely commercial space. Yeah.
Are there any questions for either of us? Speakers, sorry, can't take questions from the gallery. I'm sorry, I'm not allowed to, or not able to. Thank you very much, Nick.
Thank you.
Oh, just to speak. Okay, I don't mind. Mark, go up. Welcome to Town Hall, Mark. A little bit unorthodox, but wouldn't want to ever deny someone their voice.
Yes, thank you. Thanks for having us, Mayor and councillors. One thing I've probably got a small question about is I put a submission in as a complaint for the original one, which looked to be a cafe and bar up top. I did receive something back from the council that acknowledged that, but then recently I was only informed basically a night or two ago that registered mail was received in regards to this, of which I didn't receive anything. So that alone probably piques my interest of why I wasn't on the receiving list of that registered mail. Besides that, it's probably not something you can address, but I want it highlighted. There may be more people complaining if they actually knew there was a change again. The second thing I would say is we do get garbage bins every single hour, pretty much after midnight, and I know this is probably not the right forum, but I don't know how to raise it. In terms of prescription, I'll get the name right, prescription number 96, that covers for no garbage collection between 11 a.m. and I think 6 p.m. or 5 p.m. for Little Collins between Queen and I think the next street up, King, towards that way. I really think we need to be looking at doing the same thing there. We've really grown in terms of restaurants and noise and stuff like that. So I think, I don't know how I propose that, but I'd like it recorded that we need to drop the noise. If there's someone that could propose that, that'd be appreciated.
Thanks for those. Two good points, Mark. I'll address the second one first. So in regards to trucks and waste collection occurring outside of permissible hours, that sounds like it could be a compliance issue. So perhaps if we can take your details after the meeting this evening, I'm sure officers will be absolutely all over that one for you. So very pleased to be able to help there. In regards to your first point about notice, I might ask Ashley Trelaw or Evan Council to address that. So, Mark, perhaps you resume your seat and then I'll invite the officers up.
Clarity, I'm on the my bedroom backs onto the back of their building, basically, but down further.
Gotcha. You need to keep moving. So, Ashley, did you want to address the point about the notification?
Through you, Acting Lord Mayor, I think we might need to just take that on notice.
Sure, yep. Okay. Totally okay. All right, we'll come back to you on that first point as well.
Sorry, I'm now hearing we've got clarification, so maybe it's worthwhile hearing.
Okay, yep. Ashley, quickly if you could.
Sorry, so the revised plans which did show the changes from cafe on the sixth floor to office were circulated to all objectors via the mechanism that you submitted your objection? If not.
So it sounds like there might have been an issue with the post there. Thank you very much, Ashley. All right, I will now move the motion which is on the screen. That's it for agenda item 6.2, and I'm looking for a councillor to speak. Right. Sure, be very quick. I mean, I'm not sure how that occurred, CEO, so maybe after the meeting we can have a look at that.
If I could reiterate the noise.
Sorry, what's your name,
Michael,
sir?
Munson. I live at Excelsior, 390, okay. Little Collins. If I could reiterate the amenity, the noise factor is very important to the 41 apartments in our building. If I could also ask for a hotspot curfew for garbage trucks overnight. The increased noise from restaurants will happen, and we'd also like to be considered for a non-smoking lane, if that's possible. But it's a cumulative effect of more and more projects, and we live with the ongoing difficulties with that. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Mark. Those points were well made. I have put the motion, and you're seconding it, Councillor Leppard. Thank you very much. I'll speak briefly to this matter. Firstly, let me acknowledge the residents of the Excelsior building. In many regards, you are pioneers of inner city living. If you go back to the 1990s and the postcode 3000 policy, when people first started residing in the city, that Excelsior building was one of the first to have residents fill it. And it's not surprising because it's a great building and I'm sure you very much enjoy living there. I think the good news is that I think the main objections which you have made about this particular development have actually been addressed in the most recent proposal that has been lodged, that there will not be a bar or a restaurant or any hospitality venue on the upper levels of the building. And in fact, it'll be used for office accommodation. As for smoking in the laneway and also the truck movements, look, I think they're good points. Let's take them up offline after this evening's meeting. In terms of the application that's before us, I've got to say I think there's a lot to like about it. The two buildings that are involved are not, in fact, heritage buildings, but I think they could be accurately described as buildings of character. They certainly do add something to MacKillop Street, and they've got, they're very nice buildings, they look good, and they really add a lot to the character of that area. And I'm delighted to see that the proposal before us actually retains those buildings, not just the facade, but all of those two buildings is retained, and then the three stories which are being added on top are recessed, and so they will not be visually imposing on the street. And I've also got to say that the design of them by the architectural firm Architecton, I think they've done some great work. So I actually think it's going to be a great addition to MacKillop Street, which will in fact add value to the Excelsior and those people who live along the street. And reflecting that quality, let's hope we see two good restaurants go in the ground level as well. Beyond that, I don't have a lot to add other to say that, yeah, I think this is actually a development which will make a positive contribution to the city. Councillor Leppert.
Thank you, Chair. I agree. This is a brilliant design and it's not an application that seeks to overdevelop or push the envelope too far. It's something that's very thoughtful of its the context of the street and the buildings around it. It isn't a building that does have any heritage protection, as you say, but I think that the restoration of parts of the building, the removal of some of the unfortunate additions over the years is actually going to result in a facade that is superior to what's currently there, and that's not usual to observe. And so I think that really should be pointed out and acknowledged and thanked. Around notice, I just picked that up during the submissions. Of course, given that there's no heritage controls and that the use isn't of a particular type, there was no formal notice and advertisement for this application. Obviously, the local residents and others have picked up on the fact that there is an application here, brilliant, and have lodged objections or submissions, which we've treated like we would as though formal notice and advertisement would have occurred, because we do that, and I'm very glad that we do that. So there's no procedural error here. It's unfortunate if there's been some post issues that have gone wrong here, but I just wanted to acknowledge that the level of correspondence with objectors is 100% more than is required under the Melbourne Planning Scheme and the Act. I'm not saying it's all great, but I just wanted to acknowledge that our team does work quite hard to take into account all of those objections that are voluntarily, if informally, lodged in an area where objections and advertisements and the ability to appeal is completely exempted. Finally, I just wanted to manage some expectations around the rooftop. The applicant is obviously doing everything that they can to respond to feedback and to ensure that the new proposal is integrated with the community and the different uses in the area. A cafe on the rooftop as far as I can tell, is something that doesn't need a permit at all. Liquor licences are another matter. Making sure that there's public access and it complies with all the other parts of the schemes is another matter. But the use there was as of right. A bar is a different matter as well. So, yes, it looks like it's going to be commercial tenancy and that the expansive rooftop will be used by the private tenants of that area. But I just wanted to make it clear that it's not going to be a bar and that would require a new planning permit. A cafe may be another matter. But I'll just conclude where I started by congratulating the applicant on putting forward a proposal that, yes, is of excellent design.
Thank you, Councillor Lippert. Are there any other speakers for or against the motion that is before us? In that case, I will... Oh, sorry. Acting Lord Mayor.
Thanks, Councillor Rees. I won't go into... I think you've both spoke really well in terms of the development itself. It is an excellent design. I just want to pick up on a couple of issues in terms of detail from our submitters tonight. So if it's not a prescribed area in terms of those hours for rubbish collection, then we'll pick up on that detail and work through that process. In an overall sense, the waste and resource recovery strategy is very much trying to reduce the number of truck movements in the city because we recognise the amenity impacts for residents. And then in terms of the smoke-free side of things, I think you can sort of see with Bourke Street and sort of where council is heading towards. It may not be sort of an overnight solution, but you can see that those sort of many impacts for residents are being looked into as well. So I hope that does sort of add to that allaying of fears with no nightclub.
Thank you, Acting Lord Mayor. Are there any further speakers for or against the motion? In that case, I'll put the matter to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands, looking at all councillors, and I confirm that motion is carried unanimously. And I'll also invite people who are waiting out in the corridor there to please come and join us. There's quite a queue there. And I might just again pause for a moment just to let people sit down. All right, we're a couple of councillors down, but I think we'll make a start. The next agenda item is 6.3, and that's a ministerial planning referral, TPM 2018-23, for the property 23 to 38 Pearl River Road and 3 to 43 Waterfront Way, Docklands. Would councillors like a presentation in relation to this item? I take that as a no, and so I will therefore call on Ellie Harrington, who requested the opportunity to address the committee in relation to this matter. Welcome to Town Hall, Ellie. You are invited to speak for no more than 3 minutes.
Thank you, Chair and Councillors. So my name's Ellie Harrington and I'm from SJB Planning, who's representing the permit applicant, or the applicant for this proposal rather. So the addendum before you tonight is the realisation of the extensive work undertaken by our client and the project team really over the past couple of years in consultation with officers from the City of Melbourne, DELP, Development Victoria, local traders and the local community. The addendum seeks to optimise opportunities for urban intensification in an urban renewal precinct and in a manner which responds to the emerging character of the surrounds whilst also ensuring diversity in built form is achieved. The building envelopes and built form guidelines contained within the addendum seek to protect views to and from the wheel, contribute to a visually interesting skyline, increase activation of key streets, and ensure buildings are designed to create a comfortable street environment. Avoidance of unreasonable shadow impacts and wind impacts have also been prioritised. We thank the planning officer for their thorough report and for the collaborative process and willingness to meet with us on several occasions to discuss the addendum and work through the key items that have been raised by both City of Melbourne and DELP. We also thank the planning officer for the opportunity to submit a response and an amended addendum after the meeting to address some of these concerns. The addendum before you provides much clearer guidance with respect to built form parameters for each site than those currently contained within the development plan. These parameters ensure future development on each site provides high levels of on-site and off-site amenity and contribution to the public realm among others. In particular, with respect to built form parameters for the sites, the addendum proposes maximum building heights, and really those are largely driven by shadow impacts as well, or take shadow impacts into consideration. Maximum gross floor area requirements for each site are also proposed, which will also further refine the ultimate built form to be achieved on each site. Prescriptive building setback and separation requirements, both within the site and from boundaries. And importantly, our client is committed to locking in a commercial land use for the southwest site, in particular the taller tower, and has agreed to enter into a Section 173 agreement to confirm this, and that's made its way into the addendum. So in conclusion, the applicant respectfully requests the committee lend its support tonight in line with the recommendation of officers to an addendum which will provide the foundation for the continued revitalisation of Docklands. Our client's excited to continue redeveloping key sites within Docklands, noting the construction of the southeast site, which is an already approved Marriott and residential development, is already well underway. And again, thanks council and councillors for the opportunity to present. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ellie. Are there any questions? No, it doesn't look like it. Thank you very much for your presentation. Just confirming we don't have any other speakers on this one. No, we don't. So I am happy to move the motion that is... I just need to get my glasses upgraded, everybody. The motion that is now up on the screen, and I call for a councillor to second the motion. Thank you, Councillor Leppert. The application before us is, the next stage, if you like, in the development of Waterfront City and the development plan, which has been some time in the making. I think it's been 2 years or possibly more of discussions which have led to us being here this evening. While 2 years is a long time, it is certainly the case that we're talking about two sites moving from 25 metres to 90 metres on the southwest site and 70 on the southeast site. So that is something that obviously the city wants to properly interrogate. On a bright note, I think that that the changes that the city is seeing at the district at the moment are very positive, and it's exciting to see what's happening there. And I think that's going to add a lot to Docklands in terms of amenity and vibrancy of Docklands. So well done on that front. It is also the case that the development plan for this particular area does reference the desire for sort of visual markers on these locations, and also makes the point that that the wheel should be referenced with these built form controls, and the proposal before us holds true to that. I think it's important to note that there is a legal agreement that is will be put in place between the city and the proponents. Good work to our officers on that. That agreement will require that these sites are a mixed use development that will include office, retail and hotel, and I want to say I think it's particularly pleasing to see more office going into this part of the city. I think it's an important part of Docklands' formation as a fully rounded, vibrant throughout the day part of our city. I also would expect that as a result of tonight's decision, assuming that it is approved by councillors, we will now see some new applications coming forward for planning permits in this area. And I guess I want to emphasise that I do hope that those new applications, if they do indeed come forward, are of a very high quality. I don't want to see any more prefabricated concrete buildings in Docklands. I think we've had quite enough of those. I'd like to see buildings come forward with a high quality materiality, a good quality veneer. Dare I say, even a nice brick veneer would be, I think, very well received by council. And also, we are receiving a lot of applications at the moment for signage around that area, Ellie, so be good to see something coherent coming forward on that front as well. So looking forward to further applications coming before it that are high quality design, high quality materials and a nice coherent signage strategy to go with them. On that note, I'm very happy to endorse the motion that's before us. Councillor Leppett.
Nothing to add. Thanks, Chair.
I'm disappointed. Are there any other speakers for and against the motion before us? Ah, Councillor Riley.
Thank you. Look, I know progress is progress and Docklands is moving at a very fast rate, but I was disappointed when I read that the vista from Melbourne Star was going to be covered with a beautiful building, but still the vista of the Star is not as we have known it. And the other thing that bothered me was the overshadowing. It can be a bit dreary down in Docklands on a cold, windy day. The sun doesn't come through, and then this overshadowing of parks and so forth really did concern me. I do also understand that progress is progress, and it is a really well-designed place. But just be more conscious of our beautiful views.
Thanks, Councillor Riley. Off the back of that, I might just put a question to officers on overshadowing. So can I just clarify that it is the case that the proposal before us tonight will lead to no additional overshadowing during the summer equinox of what is already permitted on these sites?
Yes, thanks, Councillor Reeson, through you. Yeah, confirming that there's no additional shadow cast at the summer period between 11 and 2. Also, you'll note that in the recommendation there's a condition around June between 11 and 2 also to ensure that no additional shadow on that parkland to the south as well.
Yeah. Not perfect, Councillor Riley, but I think acceptable in the circumstances given the controls that that are open to us in the circumstances. Any other speakers? Councillor Watts.
I'm picking up on Councillor Riley's comment about the views, and it occurs to me, having not long come back from London, that huge and spectacular buildings do add to the views of such as the Star, for example. What a pity we're getting such boring buildings when other comparable cities in the world have buildings showing imagination and flair, and I would really hope that those architects servicing our city become a bit more mindful of the opportunity that they have to do something of interest.
Thank you, Councillor Watts. Any other speakers? Councillor Pinder.
Chair, could I ask Evan a question? Is that okay?
Given I'm chairing, I'm very happy for that to occur.
Evan, do you know the level of consultation that's taken place between District Docklands and the Star? Has that ever been mentioned to us or on this? For the okay, can I ask?
Sure. Ellie, would you like to answer that question, Ellie Harrington?
Sorry, what'd you say?
If you don't have the answer at your fingertips, that's okay. We can take it offline. Okay, excellent.
Whilst Ellie's searching for the specific answer, within the delegate report, it does make mention of community consultation undertaken by the applicant in preparation of the addendum this evening, and I'm fairly certain that the Star was consulted through that process as well.
I'm led to believe that discussions are currently underway.
Discussions might be continuing.
Between the two parties.
Discussions may be continuing, remembering that this evening what we're considering is an addendum to the development plan and further design detail to what future buildings will look like will be being undertaken, most likely at this point in time.
Thanks, Evan.
Ellie, we're happy to give you the final word on this matter before we put it to a vote.
Sorry, just with respect to the community engagement that was undertaken, I was just searching for this helpful summary report that we had Kipir put together for us that was lodged with the addendum application. There was extensive consultation that occurred really over the past couple of years with District Docklands, with the Melbourne Star Wheel. We had community information sessions, mailbox drops, information flyers in the Dockland News Readers. So this was all undertaken as part of the process.
I'm not talking about community consultation. Stakeholder. I mean, they are a major stakeholder.
Yes, so they were engaged with, and we had a briefing session with them.
How long ago?
This was held in... would have been late last year.
So a year ago. Chair, I've got a bit of a problem here because I've been told that... my information leads me to believe that this major stakeholder is of the view that there are discussions taking place, but I guess as Evan has indicated, and it's to do with the height of the buildings. So will that come later, Evan? Because I'm a little bit...
Yeah, so can I suggest to you that what we are discussing this evening is a... amendment to the development plan and the actual... I strongly suspect that what we're going to see down the track now are some updated planning permits. And
absolutely.
So I suspect the points that you're going tonight will be fulsomely debated at a later date. On that...
May I just add, please? Why we're so adamant that this consultation with Melbourne Star... the owner of Melbourne Star is coming into Town Hall next week for a courtesy call from Osaka, mm-hmm. and questions will be asked of us as councillors. So we really want the information to be accurate, mm-hmm. so we don't give any falsified information.
Yep, understand.
Okay. Are there any other speakers for or against the matter? In that case, I'll put the matter to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. I declare that carried unanimously.
All right, thank you.
The next agenda item is agenda item 6.4. It's a Ministerial Planning Referral TPMR 2019-1. It's for the property 423 Bourke Street and 140 Queen Street and 150 Queen Street and 21-27 MacKillop Street, Melbourne. That's quite a few properties. Would councillors like a presentation on this agenda item? I'll take that as a no, but Councillor Lippitt, you have a question.
I might ask a few questions after the submitters as well, but I just note that we've got representatives from Strata Title Lawyers and the Fairfax House Owners Corp, and I just wanted to get some clarity on the status of the legal agreement attached to a previous planning permission to provide a laneway. The suggestion is that this planning application shouldn't be pursued until the status of that legal agreement is clarified. So before we commence, can I just ask Evan, please, if you can give us an overview of this issue. Thank you.
Yes, of course. Thank you, Councillor Lippitt, and through you, Chair. By way of background, the existing agreement on the title is a product of a previous planning permit application, ministerial planning permit application from 2008. That planning proposal or that planning permit has never been acted upon and has since expired in 2013. Notwithstanding before the permit expiring, the part of the planning permit relating to an agreement for a future laneway to be executed on title was fulfilled, and that's the agreement which you're referring to. It's worth noting that there's an existing building over the land, so there's no public utility flowing on from that at the moment, and that was a negotiated outcome relevant to that particular development proposal. The agreement was between the landowner and Melbourne City Council, and the agreement stipulates that agreement can be ended with the agreement of both parties.
Any further questions, Councillor Lippitt?
Okay.
All right. Thanks very much for that, Evan. I will now call on Catherine Barber, who requested the opportunity to address the committee in relation to this matter. Is Catherine with us?
Yes, I am.
I'd invite you to make your way to the lectern. Catherine, thanks for joining us here at Town Hall. The rules of this place are that you have 3 minutes, up to 3 minutes, to address us.
Okay. Chairman, councillors, I just wanted to clarify... Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you very much.
Could I just clarify what was said at the end of that statement? I didn't quite get it. That the agreement was terminated when the property was sold. Is that right? To a new developer? No. Sorry?
So, Catherine, you've got 3 minutes to address us. Can I suggest you soldier on with your presentation?
I don't actually have one, but that's the only point I wanted to clarify.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you for putting that question. I invite Evan Council to respond to it.
Thank you, Chair. Through you. So the agreement does still currently exist on the title. And the terms of that agreement are that it can be terminated with the agreement of both parties. And as I went through, it relates to a previous development that's now expired. So there's no requirement that it be terminated at this point in time. It can be terminated at a future point in time. It's now redundant as a result of the permit expiring in 2013.
Thank you for that, Evan. And I can see Catherine's head nodding at the back there, so I'm taking that as affirmation. I now call on Sonia Ordino to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Is Sonia with us?
Sonia, I'm able to attend
tonight. Great, all right.
Also, Chiro, who might be next on the list.
Chiro, he is indeed, Chiro Figaro. He's got the best name we've heard tonight. Unfortunately, we won't get to hear from him. I now call on Sarah Horsfield to speak for no more than 3 minutes. Welcome to Town Hall, Sarah.
Thank you, Councillor Rees, and thank you, councillors. My name is Sarah Horsfield, and I'm a director at Urbis, and I'm here representing the permit applicant, Cbus Property, tonight. The development proposal before you tonight is quite significant to the city on a number of fronts. Firstly, it brings over $1 billion of investment in premium office space to the CBD. It delivers over 10,000 permanent and construction jobs and will house around 4,500 office workers in an environment that affords quite outstanding workplace amenity. From an architectural perspective, it will bring an iconic form to anchor the corner of Queen and Bourke Streets that achieves 5-star Green Star rating and 5.5-star Neighbours Energy rating. And finally, to revitalise MacKillop Street, it introduces a four-level wellness and recreation hub that's going to be the centrepiece of the site's amenity offering. Now, on a planning front, I am delighted to confirm that the scheme is 100% compliant with DDO 10. In fact, it's more than compliant because it has more than generous setbacks to MacKillop Street to preserve the amenity of that space. It actually has a lower tower height than the planning scheme would allow, and its plot ratio at 29.8 to 1 is actually less than what we are entitled to because of the quantum of commercial office space that's being proposed. So the project benefits from a very significant floor area uplift by virtue of just the sheer quantum of office space proposed, so it's not surprising that in commercial terms the public benefits equivalent to around $44 million. And it delivers benefits beyond the commercial space because it's delivering a 580-odd square metre recreational space which will be available not just for the office workers but for broader public use and enjoyment, and I'll talk a little bit about what that means in a moment. Now, from a heritage perspective, the site includes the former Scottish amicable building at 140 Queen Street, which is of local heritage significance. The facade in particular is identified as being of aesthetic and architectural significance. The design scheme actually originally proposed to retain and celebrate that facade and incorporate it within a contemporary building form, but partway through the planning process, and it was some months in, we found that the concrete panels had actually deteriorated to a point that that simply made them unviable and unsafe from a public safety perspective to be retained. So we've had a number of engineering assessments, and there's been consensus from the city, from DELT and council's planners that the building simply can't be retained. Kian, our architect, is going to talk to that in a moment. Lastly, I want to just talk a little bit about the amenity that's offered in the MacKillop Street Wellness Recreation Hub. The intent is to create a fairly distinctive place that focuses on health, amenity and wellness. It goes directly to Council's infrastructure framework, which talks about the need for additional indoor rec space in the city, and this proposal will deliver that for the benefit of the workers and the surrounding population. I might hand over to Keon Davis, who's going to just talk to the design merits.
Okay. That's good timing, because Keon Davis is down here as our next speaker, so I'd invite him to the lectern from Bates Smart, I believe.
That is correct.
So the rules are you've got 3 minutes. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Councillor Rees, and thank you, councillors. I think Sarah has set the scene well. What I wanted to do is really talk through the proposition from an architectural sense. We see a great responsibility in designing a building that occupies a key corner in the HODL grid. Some of the most loved buildings in Melbourne occupy these corners. There's one directly across the road. In fact, there's two, really, if you look at the New Century ones. And they often have a distinct architectural character. They have materiality, they have detail, they have articulation, and they have a sense of the time that they are built in. We see an opportunity to build on that legacy with the idea of developing a diverse streetscape that utilises current technology in the same way that the faience buildings of yesteryear, and also particularly the innovations that characterise the Queen Street facade in terms of 1960s precast concrete, are interpreted in a contemporary way using moulded GRC to introduce a sense of natural form, of delight and of innovation. We see this as being a signifier of a different kind of commercial building, one that is more focused on people and one that provides a sensitive and defined and diverse streetscape, acknowledging that we effectively have three important frontages. The natural forms are an important part of that, as is the detail and materiality and the diversity. So the scale of diversity is important. As Sarah's mentioned, we've had a series of very productive, and we thank the Council Urban Design Team particularly for their insight and their input into the development of the concept of a revitalised and a reinterpreted Queen Street facade that will be developed further with the council, but the intent being that there is a reinterpretation of the cellular and masonry character that will still be developed as part of the conditions of the permit that we're seeking. The importance being that it relates directly to the tall element on our corner, but also to the very, very important ACA building, which is directly to the south of us. And we recognise the proportion, the verticality, and some of the fine detailing that define the streetscape of that important building. As Sarah mentioned, the MacKillop Street building responds to an entirely different context. It is a building designed to exist on a laneway. It has a different character. It is, in a sense, a building that is about welcoming people in and providing a diverse streetscape architecture that is about, you know, driving engagement to the upper levels and really having a focus on the well-being and amenity for the inhabitants of the building itself, but also of the surrounding context. So we see this as an important contribution and one that is in keeping with the scale, particularly given the diversity of MacKillop Street. You know, 423 is a 1960s building that is you know, above 40 metres, and we have the significant buildings to our south as well. Importantly, we also have a highly active ground plane. The idea is that we are bringing people into the building from all aspects, that we are activating all levels. And on the basis of the architectural quality, the idea of producing a humanistic, a sculptural form that is of high quality and high performance, we respectfully request that the application be considered tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Kian. Any questions for our speaker? No. Okay. Thank you very much for addressing us this evening. I am... yes, you can. Councillor Leppett, Evan, could you please... make your way to the lectern.
Thanks, Evan. Thanks, Chair. The structural integrity of the heritage building has already been discussed tonight. It's been described as unfortunate that some months into the planning of this application by the applicant, the concrete frames were found to be in a poor state. The delegate's report references an engineer's report that's been peer-tested by DELP, I believe, and I'm just wanting to understand the veracity of the conclusion there, because we don't have access to that report. We have access to a paragraph in the delegate's report that suggests
that the conclusion is that the building is in decline, but I'd like to be certain that that's the case and understand that that's what DELP would determine. They'll ultimately advise the Minister after we've advised them. So can you describe the veracity of that conclusion and how much room we have to move here?
Most certainly. Thank you, Councillor Lippitt. I think it's worth interrogating, given the key threshold here is demolition before we look at the replacement building. And I can confirm that our officers were provided with a copy of the engineer's report and did inform the assessment. Our heritage advisor also had access to the same documents. It was mentioned in submissions that members of the public might not have had access to that this evening. They should contact DELP if they'd like to interrogate that prior to the Minister making a decision.
But you're happy to confirm that as far as the City of Melbourne's concerned, demolition should be supported because of the structural state of the building?
Yes, most definitely.
Thank you.
Any further questions? No. All right, thank you very much. Any other questions for Evan while he's on his feet? No. Okay, in that case, I'm happy to put the motion which is up on the screen and look for a councillor to second it. Thank you, Councillor Leppett, for seconding that. And I will speak briefly to this agenda item. Look, it's not every day that we have a billion-dollar project before our Town Hall for consideration. And so in that respect, this is a red-letter item that we are considering. It's true that this application has been a long time in preparation, but look, I guess that's the way things are with a project of this scale and ambition. And look, there's obviously been a lot of work that has gone into getting us to where we are this evening, and the result, though, is terrific. The result is actually an exemplar of what we want to see in the City of Melbourne. I think Bates Smart have done an absolutely exceptional job with the design of this building. You know, I often bemoan the preponderance of featureless glass towers going up around the place, and this design is very much the antithesis of that. It's a very thoughtful, elegant and interesting design, and I mean the podium in particular reminds me of a curtain being pulled back around the entrances, and I think the response on MacKillop Street as well, recognising the scale of the laneway, is very thoughtful, and the building or side of the building that's replacing the Scottish amicable insurance building is very thoughtfully done as well. I also very much like the proposal for the wellness centre and the creation of publicly accessible recreation space. I think that'll be a real addition to that part of the city. I only wish that more folks from the Excelsior building were still here, because they're going to have some great new publicly accessible space that I'm sure they will utilise to the benefit of their building and all the folks that live there. I guess one aspect of the application which has received a lot of attention is around the demolition of the heritage building, the Scottish Amicable Insurance Building. It is indeed a building that was designed by Yonkin Freeman, who are such great architects of this city, and I think many of their designs from the 1960s, I think the city is only growing in its appreciation of their buildings, and so it is, I think a matter of regret that that this building has been found to be structurally unsound and is therefore going to be demolished as part of this redevelopment. I guess on the positive side, Bates Smart have really stepped up here and come up with a design which I think is in many respects the equal of the great Yonkin Freeman, and which will serve our city well and Queen Street well, and Bourke Street, I should say, for many, many years to come. Finally, again, I know there's been a lot of work done on this proposal, and I'm delighted to be able to say that it is DDO 10 compliant, it is C270 compliant, You know, C270 is something that's getting debated a lot in Melbourne at the moment. In fact, there's a review underway by the planning minister. And, you know, I guess what we're seeing here is a $1 billion project for Melbourne that is compliant with C270, that is compliant with DDO10. And, you know, I guess what it shows is that if you work hard, you can still get big projects away in this town that do comply with the existing planning laws. The truth of the matter is that tall towers require setbacks. Good urban policy, good planning policy would, in my view, always require that tall towers have setbacks to preserve the streets of Melbourne. And here we have a $1 billion project, a tall tower, an office tower that's C270 compliant and is going to bring $1 billion of activity into our city. So on that note, I'm very, very happy to move the motion. Councillor Leppett.
Thank you, Chair. I hope it's a $1 billion project because the Metropolitan Planning Levy that will apply will be much juicier than the $300 million that's suggested in the paper. But whatever it is, this is a massive project and it's not a square site. It is a project that has lots and lots of different elements to it, and the care and thought that has gone into designing those different elements really is quite fascinating. I too started with the demolition question, because it is a threshold question before you decide whether the replacement should be supported as well. You should only approve demolition under the Melbourne Planning Scheme if there is reason to do so after you've considered the level of significance and considered what might replace it. It's why I asked so many questions about the engineering report and the conclusion that DELP appears to have reached, that the building should be demolished because it can't be safely retained. I accept that. Those are the words in the document, and we've tested that tonight. I just make the point that making heritage reviews and progressing them through the planning scheme as planning scheme amendments is like pulling teeth. C271 has applied new permanent controls to one of the buildings in question here, and that was a laborious process to get here. So it is very unfortunate that just a couple of months after permanent controls were gazetted for one of the buildings in the project site, we are advising DELP that we would support the demolition of that building. So we should only do so for very, very good reasons, and I think we do have those good reasons, but of course at the same time it is massively disappointing that we have to do that. The Chair's gone to great lengths about the Yonge and Freeman design there in the first instance. There's proposals to reimagine many of the elements of the verticality of that building and how it integrates with the street and buildings around it, which I think are very, very commendable. At the same time, though, it is disappointing that we can't retain the original building. Also concerned about the relationship between Fairfax House, Excelsior House. I think that that's where a lot of the objections have come from. Obviously, it's a very difficult part of the city to get right when you've got an irregular shape of the building there. How it integrates with its neighbours is always going to be a challenging question. We do have lots of detail from objectors requesting certain types of treatment for the windows that abut very closely other apartments with only very narrow laneways in between. I'm confident that everything that needs to be considered has been considered and that some of the details that are being requested go beyond what's can be considered in a planning framework, but that the applicant is very, very aware of those tensions and how the treatments of some of those uses at the lower levels where they abut some of our older apartment buildings will need to be built very, very sensitively. So on the whole, again, it's a fascinating proposal. A lot of care and design has gone into it. Disappointed about the heritage outcome, but certainly the Minister should be supporting this application.
Thank you, Councillor Leppett. Acting Lord Mayor.
Thanks, Chair. I agree with both yourself and Councillor Leppett. And I think, you know, when you look at this site, it is, you know, it's a super site in terms of its proportions, but the individual treatment of this site and how it respects the various street frontages, I think, is exemplary. And it wasn't too long ago when we were sort of worrying about the direction of commercial office space in our city, extremely low vacancy rates, so to welcome sort of in the order of, you know, 4,500 new workers to our city. Earlier on, we were debating, you know, some of the pressures and challenges that puts on the city with our transport strategy. But with this planning application, we've got an applicant in CBUS, which is really changing how our city looks and operates. And I think when you add this type of quality development into the city, it doesn't just play a role in terms of the functionality in the office space. It really does define new parts of the city in terms of urban design. So we're one of the fastest growing cities in the OECD, and I think to see a development of this magnitude, $1 billion, as our Chair has repeated a number of times, the economic activity that will bring in terms of the construction phase, this is absolutely fantastic for the city, and I congratulate the applicants. I love the fact that Sarah started with the fact that he's compliant. It makes our job a little bit more easy when we provide advice to the Minister. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Acting Lord Mayor. Councillor Watts.
Just very briefly, I'm hearing reimagining, and I'm hearing the quality of the work, and I'm hearing regret that we have to demolish this building, and I'm wondering if there isn't some scope from these designers, who clearly have thought long and hard about all of this, to provide some sort of informational interpretation of that which is being destroyed for this to be built. Surely there's scope within such a project to actually inform the public ongoing of what has been taken away, and I would like you to consider that.
It's a good question, Councillor Watts. Kian, I might invite you to address that, because I believe it actually was something that was considered, and certainly some questions were asked by us here at the City of Melbourne on that very point. So perhaps you can address how, from an architectural perspective, you responded to the Scottish amicable building and the need for its demolition.
Certainly. Thank you, Councillor Watts, for your question. The first point, I think, as Sarah has pointed out, that there is a condition on the permit for recording and proper recording of the building before any works commence. The second point, in terms of how we might go about the reinterpretation, it was a process that was very much in collaboration with the urban designers at the City of Melbourne in terms of understanding how a new facade, which is built out of a material that is not too dissimilar to the way that those precast brise-soleils were constructed, might replicate perhaps, but reinterpret the proportion and the level of detail and materiality. So if you look at the existing facade, there's a cellular in nature, there'll be a reference deliberately to that, but also to the method of construction. So that effectively what we're talking about is a way of building in the 1960s, which was innovative at the time, and we're talking about a new materiality which is becoming prevalent in our cities, which is, you know, moulded concrete, which is able to achieve some really interesting shapes and textures and forms that will basically pick up on that spirit of innovation as well. So both in terms of its form, but also in terms of its process. Does that answer the question somewhat?
Somewhat, thank you. I'm actually more interested personally in making sure that into the future people see what was there. And I gather you've given that thought too, so I thank you.
That's correct, yeah, thank you.
A good question, Councillor Watts. Any further speakers for or against the motion? In that case, I will put the matter to the vote. All those councillors in favour, please raise a hand. I declare that carried unanimously. I now call on the Acting Lord Mayor, Aaron Wood, to resume the role of Chair for the remainder of the meeting.
This concludes the reports from management to be considered. There's one item of general business to be considered. That's agenda item 7.1, the notice of motion from Councillor Nick Francis-Gilley ensuring safety of children at places of worship in our municipality. And I call on Councillor Francis-Gilley to move a motion with respect to the matter.
Thank you, Acting Lord Mayor. I'd like to move the motion on the screen, the amended motion on the screen.
And I call for Councillor Leppett to second that. Thank you, Councillor Leppett. Councillor Francis-Gilley. Apologies, I did write those down and then completely missed them. Chris Thrum, you asked to submit to this item? Okay. Stephen Mayne.
Thank you, Acting Lord Mayor. I would like to speak in favour of this motion and also to speak in favour of the concept of councillors putting up motions. So I think it's good that you've done this. It's a sort of motion that you obviously can't really have an officer report on. So it's quite a political, sort of contentious motion, but it's the councillors taking a position on the Catholic Church and their recalcitrance in relation to new laws on mandatory reporting of child abuse. And I just want to throw in one extra consideration for council in addition to the words on the motion, and that is that I was talking to the former CEO of City of Melbourne, Cathy Alexander, the other day, and she mentioned that she's currently chairing the state government's review of the rating system. And obviously one element of that is that the Catholic Church and all churches and all places of worship are exempt from council rates. Now, the Catholic Church owns about $100 billion worth of assets in Australia, including billions in the City of Melbourne. And just in addition to this motion related to the Catholic Church, I would just encourage you to think about maybe taking a position on the lifting of that rates exemption as a further way that council could put pressure on the church to comply with the law. I mean, they're in a very privileged position. They've abused that privilege. They are being recalcitrant in relation to the new law. You are proposing to take a strong stand tonight in a political statement, and an additional piece of leverage you could have would be to point out their privileged and subsidised position on the rates exemption, and given there is a state government review on that at the moment, council could do a submission to the Cathy Alexander review, putting a position that may require all churches, including the Catholic Church, to contribute something to the council's rate base, rather than everyone else in the city having to pay for the functioning of the city and the church has been completely exempt from any contribution. Thank you.
Thanks, Stephen. And as Councillor Francis Gilley has moved the motion, Councillor Leppard has seconded. Councillor Francis Gilley.
Thank you, Acting Lord Mayor. I think I'm going to try and take this slowly. I've received lots of communication about it, but first of all, I just might start by saying I'm an Anglican priest. I returned my license to officiate as an Anglican priest over 10 years ago. So, although I am still an Anglican priest, I no longer practice as a priest in the Diocese of Melbourne. Although I did, and I think, in fact, part of my returning of that license was due to the kind of issues that we'll be discussing tonight. I think the second thing is that there's a slightly amended motion. I think that's really helpful, and I thank you to Councillor Leppert, Councillor Rees, and Councillor Wood for their support in looking at that today. I would just say to those people, many people have corresponded with me, and I just really want to acknowledge the pain that's created by a subject like this. I've heard in conversation, also in an email, from those who have suffered from abuse, from those who have lost children who were abused, from people in church, particularly the Catholic Church, who feel that their church is under attack. I recognise that. I recognise the pain and importance of this issue, and it's not done lightly. I would also say is that I had a really helpful conversation today with the Nigel Zimmerman, the advisor to the Archbishop, who met me this morning, and just kind of reassuring me and helping and telling me about the considerable moves since the Royal Commission that the Catholic Church are taking in terms of coming to grips with that kind of catastrophic nature of what was uncovered in the Royal Commission. I would like to say that while many of the people that have written to me and have contacted me are Catholics. This is not about Catholics. This is actually about church or all places of worship. I think the reason I had this debate and why it was raised in the document is that I became aware after the Royal Commission in terms of the Archbishop's words when they were reported, and then I went back later to see them, that he was unwilling to, under the seal of confession, mandatorily report, as is the law, a person who, during confession, admitted to sexual abuse of children. And so what that made me think about, he just happened to be one person, what that made me think about is, as an elected official in a council that's, you know, and we are really concerned about the safety of the people in this city, and particularly the safety of children, that we have all these places of worship, and I'm unaware that there are, of how many people there might be that think their faith and particular tenets of their faith put them above the law with respect to this issue. Because I don't think we can put ourselves above the law because of our faith with respect to any issue in society. And then I realized, well, no, it's not a crime until it happens. But the trouble is, we know that it has happened, and we know that it's happened to thousands of children over the years. And so my concern is if we as a council know that there are people who will not mandatorily report, shouldn't we be considering what we should do about that rather than wait? And wait to hear that somebody was abused, somebody did confess that or tell somebody about that, and that because of their faith, they didn't report that. And so this really is recognizing and commending the Victorian government for creating the laws of mandatory reporting and hearing the Royal Commission, and hearing the voices of those children and family. It's noting with concern that this, at least one priest has said this is the case, and I don't know across our places of worship and the different faiths, whether there are others that would not consider the law over their own faith. I think it asks that we request management to confirm with the Child Safety Commissioner, who is responsible for the Safeguarding Children and Young People framework, is, in the light of knowing that that's the case, do they feel confident that that framework really does safeguard and look after children? We should know that. Do they feel confident? Because they created that, and then we have the, you know, we're aware of that now, so are they confident that that safeguard, in the light of that, will look after children? And reaffirms our goal to care for children. And lastly, requests management to inform FMC, to inform us as council, what role there may be for local government in seeking confirmation of places of worship around the city, and in instances where that can't be confirmed, or actually where we are told, no, we won't, we would not mandatorily report, what action may be appropriate in those cases for a council. As I understand it, that question hasn't been asked. And I think it's important that we ask it and that we're clear so that we can say that we have looked at this, we have thought about this, and that we are saying to young people, it is important to us to ensure your safety. Thank you. Yeah.
Thanks, Councillor Francis Gilley. Councillor Leppett. Any other speakers to this item? Councillor Pinder?
Lord Mayor.
Do you just push it?
I'd like to foreshadow, if this motion goes down, I'd like to foreshadow an alternative motion.
So can you just run me through the procedure for this? I just do need to ask a CEO a question.
So why don't you put your question to the CEO and then speak to the item.
CEO, do we have any legislative or regulatory levers that that may be afforded to us in relation to 1.5?
Through you, Acting Lord Mayor, look, we don't... look, I'll need to take advice from our legal... from our legal department and get legal, probably additional legal advice. Under the Local Government Act, no. We've got three local laws, one to do with local amenity, one to do with meeting procedures, and one which is the environmental local law. None of those would give us a legislative or a regulatory lever. But in saying that, I'm not acting off formal advice. I'd need to, if that motion is supported, adopted by council, we'd need to seek specific advice. But certainly, my view of the current of the Local Government Act and our local laws, the answer would be no. We don't have any legislative or regulatory levers.
Thanks, CEO. Any further questions, Councillor Pinner? So just to be clear, you're speaking against this motion, and if this motion would fail, you would foreshadow that you would move an alternative motion, and you would then speak against this motion, and if this motion would fail, you would put your foreshadowed motion.
Yes, that's correct.
So over to you to speak against this motion.
Okay, so thank you. Whilst this motion is a slight improvement on the one that was originally lodged, I still strongly believe that the motion takes the council into territory which it has no role or authority in. Let me preempt by saying that I do believe that obviously all that we can do to protect our children, keep them safe and nurture them, and be look after their welfare, that is paramount, and that goes without saying. But I do believe that attacking or focusing on places of worship I don't believe that this is a fair and constructive way to do it. The focus should really be on places where children participate as opposed to places of worship. I'm really glad to see that the mover has taken my suggestion of communication with the Commission for Children and Young People. That was a lot of research that I did last week and over the weekend. And earlier I did also suggest that we involve the City of Melbourne's Family and Children's Advisory Committee in any conversation or need for guidance on such matters relating to the welfare and protection of our children. I thought that this would have been a very good first step in a conversation. Unfortunately, now we're in a situation where places of worship and in particular the Catholic Church have been subjected to attack and criticism based on media reports and not knowledge of the full facts. Now, I have been in contact with the Catholic Church since for about a week and a half now. Again, may I just stress my strongest support for the mandatory reporting laws, as has the Catholic Church. They have given me their absolute undertaking that they support mandatory reporting laws. But I'm concerned about this approach that we're taking today. And it appears that we're working off media reports prior to the legislation being passed, commentary that was made prior to the legislation being passed. And I know also that the Church is currently putting into place measures to actually, and in various programs, in fact, one of their programs is training sessions to train and induct their clergy and their parish staff on all of these issues and matters. I also know that the commissioner has the safeguarding children and young people framework by the Church is due for release any day and will be on their website soon. So I'm aware of that. I just believe that 1.5 is delving into an area where this council has no enforcement capability, nor any capability to make any place where children participate. So, to write back and ask people to advise us of their intent, or otherwise in matters where we have no authority on. And I think this is likely to be met with a range of legal complexities. So I'm rather nervous about this. And I really think that we ought to be focusing on that which brings our ratepayers greater benefit, as have several ratepayers who have objected to this motion, have submitted to the motion, and we ought not to be fighting our own battles. This is not a battleground for our own personal issues. So I really believe an amended motion, which is what I'm foreshadowing if this motion goes down, is the way to go.
Thanks, Councillor Pinder. Councillor Abbott, you want to exercise your right? Councillor Abbott.
No, thank you. I understand this is a troubling, difficult, challenging issue because these are new laws, these are state laws, and the City of Melbourne's being prompted to have a discussion about what else might be possible in this space. This is a very political motion, but it's designed to be. It's already having an effect because there's press report to prompt a discussion on this very issue. So I'm delighted that, well, delighted is the wrong word, it's a very difficult debate, but I'm very grateful to Councillor Francis Gilley for prompting this discussion, for bringing this motion to us, and so that this city is having this conversation. I'm not sure what's meant by personal matters. I don't have any children, but I feel very, very passionately about this issue, that we have this public debate about what the mandatory reporting laws actually mean, how they play out in practice, and whether or not any prominent or not places of worship are going to continue to resist compliance with mandatory reporting. One example of which, among many, is the confessional seal. So I'm definitely not sure what's meant by personal matters. I think this is a matter of public importance that affects everyone, and our ratepayers have children and so on. So I think it's an important discussion that we absolutely need to have. The tweak here has been made to various parts of the motion after conversations with many, many people, and I think that the mover should be commended for taking on board a lot of those suggestions and making a whole lot of changes here. We're not proposing any particular role for the City of Melbourne yet. The conclusion of this motion is to seek advice on what roles may be able to be played in future. But let's be very clear. This isn't a motion to volunteer to become an enforcement arm on behalf of the state government to uphold its new mandatory reporting laws. This is a question about something that hasn't been contemplated in those laws and that government hasn't tackled yet, which is whether or not there's the public right to know which places of worship have articulated a position that they do not intend to comply with the mandatory reporting laws. And if that is the case, what the consequences might be. We're not determining what they are here and now. We're not tasking our enforcement officers under local laws to do any particular thing. We're prompting a public discussion about a very, very important issue, and we're not presuming where that might lead. I could speculate about where I think it should lead, but I probably won't do that because it's dangerous, because then the assumption is that that's the particular outcome that we're seeking here. I'm not seeking a particular enforcement outcome role for the City of Melbourne. I'm supporting the creation of a deliberately pointed motion that's creating a important public debate and is asking that fundamental question. If places of worship are and the institutions that sit behind them are going to declare that they are not going to adhere to mandatory reporting laws, well, where's the public interest in registering that, and then what should government do about it? We are not going to become the police on behalf of the state government, nor should we ever attempt to do that. But it's a public discussion that absolutely should be had
even if the ultimate conclusion is that the City of Melbourne does not have a role to play. I, for one, would like to know that if there are any religious institutions out there that are going to articulate that they will not comply or don't intend to comply with the mandatory reporting laws, that we would take that into consideration for all future procurement opportunities, just as one example. But I'm not there yet. We're not proposing any particular outcome. We are just continuing what I believe is an absolutely important public debate, and I sincerely thank Councillor Francis Gillie for putting this on the agenda for that reason.
Thanks, Councillor Leppett. Councillor Rees.
Thanks, Acting Lord Mayor. Look, I think the first thing that needs to be said is that this is an extremely difficult debate, and so I want to acknowledge the good grace that councillors have brought to what is a difficult discussion. I want to especially acknowledge your history, Nick Francis Gillie, as a priest and as someone who has been affected by these issues. It's a great act of bravery that you don't take a backward step on these sorts of things. Can I also say thank you for being prepared to work with us around a compromise motion, which is what's before us this evening. I think it's a motion which still goes to the spirit of what you are trying to achieve in this space, but it does it in a way which at least is acceptable to me. In terms of the spirit of what you're trying to do here, I think all councillors absolutely support you. Children are sacred. That is just non-negotiable. No one, not even the church, is above the law here in Melbourne. But importantly, this proposal, which is now before us, I think makes some quite important changes to what was being proposed previously, which I can say after a lot of reflection I can support. The first, I think, significant change is that this proposal makes clear that we are talking about all religious institutions here. This is not just about the Catholic Church. It's about all religious institutions. It also, I think, very importantly acknowledges the work that is being done by the Victorian, the good work that has been done by the Victorian Government in changing the law, but also the good work that is ongoing in terms of the Child Safety Commissioner and the Safeguarding Children and Young People framework. I agree with you, Councillor Pinder. I do not think it is the role of the City of Melbourne, and I don't think it's the role and authority of the City of Melbourne to involve itself in the investigation of these matters. But I do think, given there is a process underway being led by the state government, that it is within our remit to ask that we receive advice that in the City of Melbourne that framework is being implemented, and that the children of our city are safe. And so, in terms of what I envisage will flow from this, I envisage that the City of Melbourne officers will work with the Victorian Government, will work with the Child Safety Commissioner and provide assurances back to us that, in fact, the proper framework is being put in place in this city and the children of our city are safe.
Thanks, Councillor Rees. Any other speakers to this item? Councillor Watts?
My colleagues have been very eloquent and they are very correct. This is a very, very difficult matter. But what is not difficult is that we are elected officials and we have committed to ensuring that Melbourne is a goal, has a goal of a city caring for people, and of course children are the most important element of that as far as I'm concerned. I think the problem with this has been a semantics problem. I do think that referring to confessional seals, for example, has created the perception of one particular religious group being somehow identified. I'm aware, as most people in this room would be, that difficulties arising around child sexual abuse are not limited to one particular organisation, and not even to do with areas in which worship is occurring. It's institutional abuse, of course. So I, having reservations about this, but nevertheless mindful that quite a lot of discussion has gone on, quite a lot of concessions are being made and agreed. The wording is still not quite as I would wish, but it is close enough to what I think is a decent and honourable and well-intentioned attempt to navigate our way through what I see as quite uncharted waters in relation to the way in which the government is seeking to reform this area. I'm confident that we can be guided by the Child Safety Commissioner and the framework. I'm confident that our officers will come back to us with definitive answers to what our role might be, and I'm confident that information is always better than more information is always better than less. I don't feel we have enough information yet about the way this new system will work, and we're taking a step forward as elected representatives of our community in doing that, and so I'm happy to support this. Happy is the wrong word. I am prepared to support this.
Thanks, Councillor Watts. Councillor Riley?
Look, I've been debating this all afternoon and ever since it came up. I really do struggle with it. I've tried to come to terms with it. I honour the respect that Councillor Francis-Gilley has put forward to us. I agree with all of us around the table. Our number one priority is the safety of children. But I just cannot jump over the hurdle. This is a state government responsibility to enforce the state law. And, you know, look, they're doing their job well. And if they strongly recommend support for mandatory reporting, but compliance is an issue for the state. It's not an issue for the City of Melbourne. And that's where I get into this real turmoil with my thinking. And I also think that the community, our ratepayers, are getting to a point where they are losing patience with councillors because we seem to be ignoring the scope that we were came in to do as councillors, and that was to look after our city and our ratepayers. And I know what people will think. The children are still very much part of that. But I just think that this is not... It is our concern, and I honour the respect that is, as I give to Councillor Francis-Gilley, but I cannot see a way forward for local government by asking our CEO and staff to go away and report back with a role that we don't have any authority over.
Thanks, Councillor Riley. Any other speakers? If not, I'll speak before I hand back to the mover to sum up. So firstly, I want to say thanks to my fellow councillors for the way this debate has been conducted. I think, as my fellow councillors have said, these are difficult issues to consider and to talk through, and where, you know, people's religious beliefs are involved, and the way people have gone through life are involved are always difficult debates to go through. But what I'm assured of is that that hasn't coloured the debate and the position that the various people have taken. I want to thank Councillor Francis-Gilley for his work in working to a solution which I think many of us can support. And I think 1.5 is prudent in that what we're asking management to do is to ask what is the role of local government, because with issues like mandatory reporting, we're all beholden to mandatory reporting laws as it stands. Ali in our team does an amazing job with City of Melbourne's own operations, and indeed right across the board, City of Melbourne has such a strong commitment to child safety. I want to thank Councillor Pinder for her work across the weekend in terms of the Child Safety Commissioner, because I think there are processes in place that we need to respect as well. And I think there's also a lot of work done by those people in some of these organisations that that find, you know, what has sadly gone on in their own institutions absolutely abhorrent. So there are many people that are working towards a much safer environment for kids. I'm sad that we are in a situation where we need to be having these sorts of issues work towards, when it should just be taken as a given that our kids are safe to be kids. So I run a program called Kids Teaching Kids. I have done for 20 years. And what I also want to just highlight, though, is that each of my fellow councillors are not debating anything to do with how high we hold child safety in regard. Really what we're grappling with is what is the role of local government in this instance, and I think that's prudent, because, you know, when you're dealing with issues of such complexity, the last thing you want to do is have any unintended consequences or to enter areas which are, if there is a crime that's committed and it's a law that's broken, obviously Victoria Police are involved, and that is their role. There is a legal system that is set up for that. But I think what I can see in this motion is how do we get ahead of that game so we're not picking up the pieces afterwards, which has unfortunately occurred. And as rightly has been said by my fellow councillors, not just in any religious institution in particular, but sadly in many institutions across the world, there have been instances in this. And unfortunately for some of those kids who grow up in not the safest of environments, that often the abuser is someone that they know, is a family member. So that's the often the hidden pain that some of our young people are grappling with. So this has been a difficult issue to consider. So I'm on balance comfortable with the fact that 1.5 really does give us another step in the process to find, as Councillor Watts said, further information on that. But I want to thank Councillor Pinder and Councillor Francis-Gilley for adding elements into this motion that that means I can be comfortable in giving it my support. Councillor Francis-Gilley.
Thank you, Acting Lord Mayor. Thank you too, Councillor Pinder. I didn't realise actually that was your work. It was given to me from the Deputy Lord Mayor today. And
I was at a funeral.
Yeah, so we missed that, but thank you. I think it's a really important reference point. Let me just say a few things, though. One of the things is that this motion attacks places of worship and church, and particularly the Catholic Church. It doesn't. It's not attacking anybody. It's actually ensuring that we think carefully through whether our children are safe. And where there is ambiguity about that, we try to seek some clarity about that. That's what this is asking. I think the second thing is it clearly doesn't know what we might be able to do. And I recognize that legally there may be nothing we can do. But that's partly in the wording. The wording us is to consider what would be an appropriate response if we were aware that there were people who had children in places of worship that weren't going to undertake mandatory reporting. It would be important that we understood that and that we considered appropriately as council what we may or may not do. Not legally, but appropriately. And I think that's what it's asking our officers, and we've got some extraordinary officers in this field who I'm sure will do that work well. And I think, you know, the last thing is what is our role? And if you, you know, when you mentioned personal issues, I mean, I did go to boarding school and I was sexually abused at boarding school. That is not why I'm bringing this. You know, our role, every single one of our roles is about, and I know we know this, safeguarding, you know, our children. It's our role. And we might not have a legal responsibility, but if we're not confident, and I'm not confident currently, and if we're not confident, we should ask the professionals that are around us to check that we can be confident, that we've done everything that we could do to ensure that safety of children. That's all this is suggesting. And so I'm, you know, I'm really happy with where we've got to. I think it asks for that, ask for officers to have a look at that. I will, you know, I'm looking forward to you reporting back to FMC on what we might do to ensure that safety, if there is anything at all we can do. And I look forward, you know, with you know, some urgency on my part, but I look forward to hearing what that report will be, if we agree to the motion. Obviously.
Thanks, Councillor Francis Gillies. So I'll put it to the vote now. All those in favour? Councillor Leppett, Councillor Rees, Councillor Wood, Councillor Francis Gillies, Councillor Watts, all those against, Councillor Riley, Councillor Pinder and Councillor Louis, I declare the motion carried. This concludes the item of general business.
Sorry, Chair, just while we're in general business, under the meeting procedures code, I know it's pretty rare, but at your discretion I can ask a question. I just wanted to ask a question in relation to the ratings review to the CEO.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. Just very quickly. We've been briefed that there'll be a submission put in by management, and obviously with this and other matters that govern councillors and that can be controversial, we're encouraged to put in our own submissions. But I'm just wondering, given that 29th of October is the last opportunity to form a council position, will the management's submission be available to us as councillors for to inspect by Monday of next week, which is 8 days before the 29th of October? If it's not, that's fine. I'm just wondering if we're going to have the opportunity. Absolutely. Thank you.
And we understand the intent of the request, so let's see if we can achieve that. So take on notice.
Thanks, CEO. Thanks, Councillor Leppett. As I said, this concludes the items of general business for consideration. Are there any items of proposed urgent business? No. So we've got a 15-minute period, as we have at the start, for people to ask questions. The same rules apply, so if you could just indicate if anyone has any questions. Stephen.
Thank you, Acting Lord Mayor. I have two questions to close off the meeting. I don't want to sound like a broken record on the clock and the meeting procedures, but tonight we had 11 councillor speeches that exceeded 3 minutes with no clock running, like the clock is running now. And just on watching what was an excellent meeting overall, with really good debate, I'm not criticising anyone's contribution, but it did strike me as quite unfair that Sarah from Urbis and Kieran from Bates Smart were limited to 3 minutes and had the clock running on them and were getting beeped through their presentations when they were presenting a billion-dollar proposal to council. So the two tweaks I'd like to ask you about tonight as to whether you'd be interested in introducing are, one, to run the clock on yourselves up from zero with no limit, and two, maybe introduce a 10-minute overall limit for developer applicants so that they can then carve it up and decide who's going to take it, rather than just running the very blunt instrument of a 3-minute cap on everyone. And I do recall the former, when the pants scraper came and Cebus was putting up their previous billion-dollar proposal, a guy came out from New York and had 3 minutes on him.
So, Stephen, your two questions are about running the clock on councillors and allowing extra time for developers to present. Just developers?
Applicants.
Just applicants.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you. We're happy to take those on notice and consider them in due course. We've got a question for you, actually, Stephen, from Councillor Francis Gillies.
Stephen, you're coming to council now every session and asking us questions and giving us the notice of questions. That's very helpful. I know that from colleagues that you've express to at least them that you intend to run for council next time. I'd like to ask you, do you intend to run for council next time? And if you do, under the terms of transparency, whether each time you get up to ask questions, you acknowledge the fact that, you know, you intend to run for council next time, because it gives people the opportunity to recognise, you know, that you're there, and that's maybe part of why there are so many questions.
Happy to answer that. Life is a moving feast, and at the moment I would have to say I'm not on the roll, and I'm unlikely to run, and if I'm going to run anywhere, it would more likely be in Manningham. So that's my current position on that. So I'm a professional journalist and I'm interested in good governance, and I'm writing a monthly column for the local paper. And Councillor Wood, I didn't actually intend for that to be two questions on that one topic. I had two topics to cover, so I have one.
I assume that you had another question, Stephen, so go right ahead.
And I had two more here on my list, and I'm just going to flip a coin. I might throw one to Councillor Rees, which I've given him on notice, but it goes like this. I don't think it's too impertinent. That Victorian local government has been very lucky, in some people's view, that the major political parties have not pre-selected and endorsed council candidates in previous elections, except for some limited places for the Labor Party. The Greens, on the other hand, have had some widespread endorsements. Now, the Labor Party, I understand, has adopted a position of proposing to pre-select and endorse at next year's elections. And as a former State Secretary of the Labor Party and as a leading light who's worked for premiers and prime ministers, I'd like to ask Councillor Rees if he can provide any update as to whether it's likely or what the system would be that the Labor Party will choose to get involved in next year's City of Melbourne elections and formally pre-select and endorse both Lord Mayoral and Council candidates, to the best of your knowledge.
And this, of course, would be for someone who is not running for council elections and is not asking the question as a journalist for Docklands News.
I am doing a column on who's running.
Just important to clarify that, that's all. Yeah. So that you're asking in capacity of journalist.
This may inform that. Yeah. What's Labor doing?
Yep, good to know. Thank you. Councillor Rees, you can choose to answer that or take it on notice. It's up to you.
Look, I'll have a bit of... I might have a bit both way, if you don't mind, Acting Lord Mayor. I did arrive back in the country in the early hours of this morning, so I've been going for about 48 hours now, and so at the risk of dribbling out something quite incoherent and ill-considered, I'll take the question on notice and happy to have a chat with you online. I'm sensing a little bit of collusion here, perhaps, in the asking of that question, which makes me even more wary in my answering of it. But, you know, look, if your life is a moving feast, Stephen Mayne, then the Labor Party is a moving banquet of epic Romanesque proportions.
Thanks, Councillor Rees. Stephen?
I'd also like to thank the CEO for his one-page response on previous questions, which came through this afternoon, which was exactly how I was hoping. Nice, brief, concise and informative answers. So thank you for that.
Always good to get your compliments. Thank you very much, Stephen. Question?
In light of recent media reports around the operation of Crown Casino, I was wondering if the council was confident in that the casino is operating within its planning conditions, and if it is not confident, whether the council's got any role of investigating and finding out more.
At the risk of sort of prolonging the meeting, I think we'd need to get to the specifics of your question in terms of what planning issue that you're identifying. So let's pick that up after the meeting and we'll come back to you on answers to that question. Thank you. Are there any further questions? If not, thank you very much. I wish to thank members of the public for their interest and attendance and declare the meeting closed at 8:22 p.m.